one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, Madam Clerk, if you would do the roll call.
Councilmember Perotti?
Here.
Councilmember Bennett?
Here.
Councilmember Aceves?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tempore Vallejo?
Here.
Mayor Farr?
Here.
We had a closed session meeting. Is there a report on that?
Yes, Mayor, members of the council did meet in closed session at a special meeting this morning. Public employee performance evaluation pursuant to section 54957B with regard to the city attorney and city manager's annual performance evaluation. No reportable action was taken in those, and the council has continued that discussion onto this afternoon's agenda.
All right. Do we have any amendments or adjustments to the agenda?
Yes, Mr. Mayor, we do. Item C2 was noticed for an evening item, but the public notice that was published indicated a time certain in the evening, 6 o'clock. However, that was in error. As you know, the agenda has it as an afternoon item, so staff is suggesting we pull this item and reschedule it for December 6th so the proper noticing and agenda can go out.
Okay, so we're pulling C2.
I'm sorry, you said it was noticed for this evening?
It was. Incorrectly, it was supposed to be an afternoon item as shown on the agenda.
Can we deal with it this evening, or?
Council has the option to defer the item to the evening if you wish to do that instead.
My only concern is if it was noticed, we may get people here tonight for the item and it's not on the agenda.
All right. Well, it's within our authority here just to say we'll cover this tonight.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. Is there any reason we shouldn't do that?
Well, I would inquire of the audience if there's anyone here that was coming to speak on this item this afternoon, since it's on this agenda that is
public. I don't have a speaker slip for it.
We have no speaker slips.
Okay.
Okay, well.
I'd move that we move item C2 to this evening session.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, we all agree. C2 is going to be discussed this evening. This is the opportunity for people from the public to speak on something that is not on our agenda, and I have no speaker slips, so we will then pass forward to our first agenda item.
Item A1, Goleta Entrepreneurial Magnet 2016 End of Year Report.
All right, we have Vito Adamaitis, our Neighborhood Services and Public Safety Director, speaking, aided and abetted by Jaime Valdez, our Economic Development Coordinator. If you would, Mr.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor and members of the council. Staff is pleased to bring to you today the Goleta Entrepreneurial Magnet End of Year Report for 2016. We have here today also Mr. Dave Adornetto, the GEM Executive Director and the Entrepreneurship Program Director for the Technology Management Program at UCSB. Try saying that three times fast. It'd be pretty hard. So we're excited to have Dave here today. We appreciate the wonderful partnership that the city has with UCSB and also the Chamber. Some of you went to the Bacara event earlier this year where we had some of the teams that competed, which was really exciting to see. So without further ado, Mr. Valdez will be presenting the staff report along with Mr. Adornetto.
Good afternoon, Mayor and members of the council. Just as a little bit of a background for the public, on October 21st, 2014, the City Council approved a memorandum of understanding between the City of Goleta and GEM, including formalizing relationships and providing for an annual report that would be delivered that would cover expenditures of monies and activities throughout the year. The first report was received by the council on December 2nd, 2014, and then last year's report was provided to council on November 17th. And this annual report for 2016 encompasses the year-to-date from January through, I believe, the end of September. That's when the last financials were available at the time of putting the packet together. Just to recap a little bit, in July of 2016, the GEMS actual physical location on 600 Pine Avenue celebrated its second year in operations. Mr. Adonetto, who's here and will provide some additional information, just completed his first year as the GEMS executive director and has continued to work to explore additional strategies for increasing financial support to GEM. As Mr. Adonetto as Mr. Adamaita stated earlier, he was successful in securing significant financial and programmatic support for the 2016 G2 Summer Accelerator, which I believe Mr. Adonetto will cover in his presentation. That said, just in terms of fiscal impacts, the city supports GEM in the amount of $50,000 per year, according to the Memorandum of Understanding, and that has been budgeted for fiscal year 16-17 coming up for this budget cycle. And we just thought we'd include that information for the staff report as well. So without further ado, Mr. Adonetto will come to the lectern and provide his PowerPoint presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of council. Thanks for including us on the agenda today. I'll start with, although most of that was just provided, a brief history on GEM. The concept for the partnership, of course, was hatched in 2012. In 2014, the nonprofit entity was formed. And at the same time, the physical space was secured in Old Town Goleta. It was billed as a center of excellence for entrepreneurial growth. Unfortunately, since its inception, we've experienced some low occupancy at the facility, which I'll explain in more detail as we go forward here. But at the same time, some of the programmatic elements of GEM have, I think, been very impactful and very successful, and I will also explain some of those to you. This is the organizational chart for GEM. It has not changed significantly at all from what we presented prior year. As you'll see, all three partners are represented on the board. The Goleta Valley Chamber of Commerce is our organizing committee and provide all of our back office support. And I use an advisory committee to help me on various matters. After my arrival at GEM, we spent a considerable time sort of marking and noting what our critical objectives were. And so first, providing a safe landing place for early entrepreneurs. Offer programming and a network of mentors, angel investors, et cetera, to improve the success rate of new startups in our area. The city of Goleta's interest to make a positive impact on local economic vitalization efforts and the local entrepreneurship ecosystem for our area. UCSB had an interest in an additional outlet for commercializing technology and getting some of its innovations out. And really an opportunity for all three of the partners to do something that I think everybody felt very worthwhile for our community. So our current state, where are we today? As mentioned, occupancy has been in that 30 to 40% range really since its inception. And today it's about one-third occupied. And that's rentable space, not the number of people per se, but rentable space. We have other people in the facility, some people that we had in our summer accelerator, others that were members of GEM that couldn't afford to be there any longer, that we have extended the ability to stay a little longer to utilize the facility. They are not rent paying today, but sort of consistent with our mission, we've reached out and enabled them to stay a bit longer. Our current monthly rental income, which fluctuates from month to month, is about just under $4,000. At the end of next month, it'll be closer to $3,400. If it were rented to capacity, it would be at about $9,000 a month. Our current rent expense is $7,500. We are a sublessee of ATK Orbital, which occupies the front of the building. And we have a part-time staff and other operating expenses, keeping the building clean, insurance, maintenance, things like that, of $5,000, which results in about a net monthly cash burn of about $8,500. Our current cash balance is around $60,000. What makes things challenging in terms of occupancy, one of the things is that we compete in a relatively small geography with more than 10 co-working incubator facilities. And these facilities run one of two ways. On the incubation side, typically it's an investor, and they invest in a business. And in return for that investment, they welcome them into their incubator for a period of time, and say 3 to 6 months of free rent, after which then they go into a rent-paying mode. But since they have had an investment infusion, they are able to pay that rent. The other end of the spectrum is a co-working facility, and that would be more like the Impact Hub downtown or Work Zones. And that is a space for rent model, and that is a model that these are real estate investments for people. They are selling seats to make money. That is their goal. An additional challenge is where the building is. It's not problematic that it is in Old Town, but it is problematic where in Old Town it is, and the fact that it's behind another building, it's upstairs, the decor is rather dated, and that does create an issue with it being the magnet that we want it to be, or the entrepreneurial center. It is not necessarily a place where people want to hang out if they're not paying tenants. And part of the model here is to have a lot of influential people who want to be in the facility and be in the location. And we have a bit of a challenge with that with the current location. Thirdly, on our challenge list is the rental structure, really not just with GEM, but with any co-working facility. It's not attractive to a new startup, because new startups, unless they've received some investment, some funding, have no ability to pay rent. So what happens is we end up competing with their living rooms and their garages, and given the choice, they move. And this is proven from our accelerator, because we had all six teams working in GEM, and when it concluded, all of them left because they couldn't afford the rent. And so we've proven that out in our own model. What it is more attractive for is small professional services companies or startups that have received funding that can't afford rent. And that's who we have there now. Our tenant mix is heavily towards those two types of companies. As I mentioned earlier, the programmatic elements have been impactful, most notably the Summer Accelerator. I'm going to tell you a lot more detail about that in the next slide. Also, our mentor and angel investor network and professional referrals. I'm able to draw a lot on our programs at UCSB and my longtime career in this area to provide a network of help to all the people that cross paths. And so those have been notable and important. So the accelerator, we received applications starting in May of last year. We accepted six teams ultimately. They came from very diverse backgrounds, educational backgrounds. We had two teams from Santa Barbara City College. We had a team made up of Berkeley and Middlebury Institute of International Studies graduate students. And we had three teams from UC Santa Barbara, and that made up the six. The way the program was developed, we had classroom sessions, we had co-working and roundtables. So classroom sessions were at UCSB on Tuesdays and Thursdays. I was able to reach out into the community to get content leaders who put together a great program. On Wednesday mornings, we met at GEM to do our roundtables. It was a leadership roundtable. Every startup in the program sent one to two people. We went around the room. We talked about the challenges that were being solved. We shared perspectives on how that was being done. People who had experience in one area or another were able to help. That was a fantastic program. We made Wednesdays our co-working day at GEM, so everybody was there together. The unexpected beauty of the whole thing was the diversity. It really blew me away to see how the diversity of the teams really added to how it worked. And they were extraordinarily supportive and helpful for each other. We had team building events, and it was very impactful for all of them. In addition to what we were doing inside, we reached to the community and we had wonderful support. We were able to raise $50,000 for the program. We had a fantastic attendance from the community at our demo day. And as I mentioned earlier, through my connections at UCSB, I was able to reach out and get people to develop content, deliver the content, serve as mentors and guides for the teams. Those are still being utilized today by the teams that were at the accelerator. I'm happy to say that even only after 7 weeks, which is relatively short for an accelerator, but it was our test run, five of the six teams are still active and either have formed or are in the process of forming and taking their products to market. We've had a couple that have fielded investment offers. Another is getting a crowdfunding campaign together. So we did what we set out to do, which is really extend the runway for these companies. Because without that program, there's just nowhere to go after some of the academic programs. There's no landing pad for them. It just sort of cuts off short. So I think that greater impact can be made by lengthening it and expanding the scope of the accelerator. And should we have the opportunity again, that would be my goal. So given the financial situation, it is our responsibility to be thinking about how we best make impact for the future, given the fact that we're struggling a little on the physical space, but we're finding that our programs are what we believe is highly impactful. And so moving forward with the board, we're talking a lot about evaluating the cost benefit of having the brick and mortar building as opposed to a more programmatic presence, which would emphasize some of the things that we're doing, not necessarily in the facility. Also talking about enhancements to the startup support programs. As I mentioned, perhaps lengthening and expanding the scope of the accelerator. Perhaps a program where we subsidize rent in incubator facilities for brand new teams. Again, if this is a pre-funding stage, they don't have the money to pay rent yet. And there are some ways to structure that could be interesting to consider. We've also reached out to the local business community about an idea about perhaps taking young entrepreneurial teams and co-locating them within the businesses and have them provide mentorship. And so we've reached out to a few. We've had varied feedback. Some would be very willing to accept teams. Others are growing too fast, and they can't imagine setting aside even 200 or 300 feet for a startup. And they have some security concerns. But for the smaller businesses in our area, this seems to be very viable, who have extra space and who actually could benefit from a little bit of rental income themselves. And so perhaps GEM can play a role in that, in finding those, developing those relationships, and perhaps subsidizing some of the rent that would happen there. And again, if depending on what we do with the building and the brick and mortar, perhaps some of the financial funds can be redirected in some of these ways. We've talked about formalizing a new business toolkit, how companies get started, what permits they need, et cetera, and then just continuing to build and expand on the mentorship, investor network, and the professional referral database that we already provide. And so that's just ongoing, organic, living and breathing. And really what our goal is here is just to determine if our financial resources are being deployed as best they can to make the most impact we can, because this is important. Again, I think our accelerator over the summer has proven that we can have impact. We just need to continue to figure out how best to direct it and really maximize the impact for the investment that we're making into it. That concludes my remarks, my specific remarks, but I'd happy to field any questions if you have any.
Yeah, Ms. Perotti.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Well, thank you so much for your report. I was wondering how you all were doing over there. And I'm glad that you did mention, because one of my questions was about location and why that particular location wasn't working. Have you seen, in your experience with other startup facilities, such as GEM, have you seen locations that work better than others? Can you tell me anything about if you could move the location or what you envision would be like a better location?
Yeah. First, let me say that it's a number of things, not just the location.
Okay.
So it's really a collective of things.
Right.
In terms of the location, well, let's start with what we've created really is a co-working facility. And the very nature, any co-working facility, and there are several downtown now, and some very nice ones. If you've ever seen the Impact Hub, mm-hmm. if you haven't walked through there, they've done a beautiful job. It's gorgeous. It's also very expensive. And although they build themselves as catering to entrepreneurs, there is very few new entrepreneurs starting out a company that can afford that location. And it's gorgeous. But when you add the parking and everything else, it's very, very difficult. But even the rent structure at GEM is catered to people who have money. They've had the investment. So what we find is the startups that have been 3-4 years into it come back because they just want a place to go that's quick, easy to get to. They like the parking. They're not utilizing any of the programs because they're mature. They don't need the mentorship. They don't need the network that we're providing because they've already gotten their funding. So that's part of the challenge. In terms of the physical location itself, we could put some more money into it. We could freshen up the inside. We could make it a little more contemporary in terms of what a current co-working facility may look like. I don't know that in of itself would solve it because of where it is located. And I'm not sure it achieves our mission to help the early entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. And so it's a little bit of, that's why I say it's not as simple as that. It's also not conducive to large community events, the way it's structured and the way that our space is structured. It's got a lot of hard cubicles. And so it has a lot of little small factors that I think cumulatively add up to a challenge. Also, at one point, we were trying to put together an investment fund, and we actually had people that were leading the effort and were going to put money in that would be part of that mentorship network and hang out and be there who didn't feel that was a place to gather. By its nature, where it is and how it's set up. And so that's some feedback and a little bit of history for you.
Thank you for that.
Council Member Aceves.
Just one quick question. You said brick and mortar is kind of problematic because of cost and location. Can this program go virtual?
That's what we're looking at. Okay. And so the programmatic pieces are virtual in many regards. And so, for example, the accelerator this past summer, we did the teaching at UCSB. We could find a place for co-working. I do think that's an important element to an accelerator is to have at least a day a week where they're working together. But that there are many ways to solve that other than, I think, a building that is two-thirds unoccupied and costing a lot of money the rest of the year. And so I think it would be it behoove us to explore some of those other opportunities to do that. So I think in many respects it can be more virtual.
Okay, good.
Yeah, Mayor Pro Tem Vallejo.
You mentioned most of the tenants right now are kind of like me. CPAs or I don't know if there's any CPAs, but professionals that are using the co-working space. How many in our target market are, how many businesses are in there from the entrepreneurs we're really looking to support?
We have, I believe, three entrepreneurial, early entrepreneurs. They are not paying rent today.
They're the, so which is, okay.
They are the ones that moved out, and then we said we've got this big empty space.
Might as well use
they
that.
Had a relationship with us, mm-hmm. and so we extended them to stay through the end of the calendar year.
Okay.
Yeah.
How long is GEM's lease with the facility?
We're month to month.
Okay. Well, that's...
Yeah.
That's good.
And I must say, the landlord has been extremely cooperative with us and very supportive, and they've been very easy to work with throughout.
Okay. So you're evaluating going virtual, however you want, giving out the brick and mortar. How long do you think that process will be before you guys, before the board kind of comes to a conclusion on what they should do?
I think we've started those discussions, but I think they require a lot more thought and mm-hmm. discussion. It might be a little premature to give you an exact timeline on that. And should we find ourselves in that direction, we'd want to give the current tenants plenty of time to figure out another plan. And so I think it's something that we are working at with some urgency, but there's mm-hmm. a timeline that we'll have to fulfill.
Okay. Well, you guys have certainly been working on this issue, the location and the actual physical facility for a while now, so I appreciate the time and thought that's been put into it, and it's not... It's not a knee-jerk reaction to, oh, well, we only have three real tenants, for lack of a better term. I understand that. So I appreciate the effort and the thought that's been put into this.
Thank you.
Councilmember Bennett.
Yeah, I wanted to thank you, too, for putting forth the effort. It's always tough on the front end to make things work, and I know it's been a bit of a struggle, but I appreciate your candor and letting us know what you believe some of the issues that need to get resolved. As you might know, we're in negotiations to purchase the old DRI building over on La Patera. So my issue is, where do you think a location would make a difference that would be more compatible or palpable to those that might be involved? And that space, of course, is, I don't know if you've ever been in there, but there's great office space In addition, there's going to be a very vacant warehouse, which is kind of funky and, you know, kind of open and might lend itself to something that would be more desirable to participate in. I don't know.
Yeah. One of the challenges, too, where we are is it's not close to a ton of services. Grab a cup of coffee. There are a few around, but it's not fantastic. I think we would suffer from some of the same issues in the old DRI location. But let me get to you. The first part of your question is, and I would say it depends what we want to be. And so are we looking to be so co-working versus a more strict incubator? And I feel like if we all agree on the mission, and if our goal is to help the really early entrepreneurial team sort of pre-funding, because that's where that valley of death comes. It's a commonly used term, that valley of death. We'd spend a lot of time helping teams academically to form teams, develop an idea, start the market validation process. And then what we're trying to do in GEM and my, you know, after the academics is help them figure out how to launch, run, and build their companies. And it's a different study. And so and in that short period of time, if they don't get some help financially or otherwise, many potential companies don't even get the opportunity. And even a small percentage of them are really going to make it, but you don't even get them because they're never allowed to hatch. I mean, it's sort of a silly analogy, but they're never really allowed to hatch. And so I feel like that should be our focus, that point. And so it's probably not a place with a lot of offices. It's not a co-working office location. It's more of an incubator. And so that can take the place of a lot of, that can go to a lot of different things. It's quite possible UCSB is going to be the recipient of $2 million from state funding. AB 2664 was a law recently passed at UCSB that will have the funding to potentially create an incubator on campus. And that's a small space, very open environment. Think sandbox for adult entrepreneurs, right? And a lot of crosstalk and exchange. And so if we start to think as a more virtual program, are there ways to create scholarships or other ways that might support something like that? That might be a more valuable use of the resources. And so it's that type of environment that I think would be valuable. Another potential is, and I don't know the outcome of this long run, there may be other people looking to get into Goleta as part of the real estate play I was mentioning earlier. Impact Hub has talked about a Goleta location, and perhaps they would want a small incubator attached to theirs. And so there are ways that I think we can piggyback and attach and create partnerships with other potential things that are going to start to happen in our area. We could go and create one on our own as well, but that would require obviously some investment to do that. And then it's how do you get those teams continually to be funded so that they have a place they can stay and grow and figure that out. So that's our real challenge. It's that pre-funding, first year, which ones really have an opportunity to go, and let's give them a chance to see if there really is something there.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Ordinetto? Yeah.
Just to clarify, so it's less, because, you know, you and I have talked, and I've toured other incubators and spoken to people. It's less about location per se as the services that come with it and the feel and the vibe, you know. So we could have the most beautiful building in Goleta devoted completely to this, but if all we're doing is giving them a cube to work in, we're still not going to succeed. We need to provide those services, investment opportunities perhaps, definitely accelerator type classes. Those are the things that really will create successes, which is what we're ultimately shooting for. We're not looking for bricks and mortar per se. We're looking for success stories with these small businesses. And so that's basically the point here, right, is that we have to be less focused on bricks and mortar, more about what do these entrepreneurs need.
I think that's well said. The one possible exception is that if you don't have we do need to create a gathering place and a place that people want to be, because they provide that that vibe and that energy. And I think that's what places like the Impact Hub have done well. Mm-hmm. I know them all very well, and I think they've done a wonderful job, and the design of that building is beautiful. I don't ever really see it catering to early entrepreneurs in terms of tenants. They do have them come through a lot, and they offer some nice programs to get them in the building. But I think it's tough for them to afford it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
All right. So is there, on the bricks and mortar question versus the virtual reality, is it a question of rent at our current facility. If we drop the rent, could we get more people in there, or is it just not suitable because the nature of the businesses that need incubation don't really need what we're offering there?
I think we could get more early entrepreneur tenants if we drop the rent.
What is it now?
Well, it depends on the space that they occupy. And yeah. So the largest office there rents for $800 a month. The smallest office, $600 a month. We rent the cubicles for $350 a month. And we sell co-working memberships for $200 a month. And the reason I say that is because I have three or four teams that came back for free. So where that number is that they would pay is a good question. I don't know. I could find that out, though. It's a good question.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned, and I think it's probably in the mind of us, is trying to generate some sort of facility that would spark the interest of others and perhaps some cross-pollination going on. If we abandon the bricks and mortar in favor of the virtual, we lose the opportunity for that?
We would lose the opportunity of certainly of having it at that location, but I think we could create some of it at other locations.
Okay.
Yeah.
I kind of like the idea of finding businesses that may be compatible or at least with space that would be for rent, and we subsidize the movement of an incubator candidate in those buildings. Is that a feasible thing to do?
I think it is. I think it's probably a second phase for those teams. I think the first phase is working with other teams, becoming a little more mature, and then as they sort of pop, that's their first time out of the nest type of thing. But I think it is feasible. I think it could be very effective for the teams. As I'd mentioned, those that we've reached out to, which are the larger growing tech firms locally, didn't have as great of an interest, and mostly due to space constraints of their own, a growth trajectory that was hard for them to predict, and therefore them not feeling good about loaning space for 6 to 12 months, and some security concerns in terms of network or e-commerce things that they do, that they have to keep their networks very discreet. And so we've had some concerns, but we also have had some of the smaller businesses reply that was something that they would look at. And ideally, you'd find a match, you know, a company that's working on a certain thing that might find a company or a startup that had a similar interest, and you could match them in terms of their, so there'd be real mentorship.
So what is your suggestion to us? Do you think we should look to abandoning the bricks and mortar?
I think the suggestion at this point is to allow the board to spend a little more time to flush this out. And I wanted to give you all a feeling of the direction we were headed and the discussions we were having. And that given the financial situation, felt it was our responsibility to be looking at other alternatives so that we can continue the good work we're doing and just be, you know, use the funds as optimally as we can.
Yeah. Actually, I liked Councilmember Bennett's suggestion that we make use of the DRI, since we will own that. Now, the question is, the question of services that you mentioned, that it's not more suitable than where we are now, but we could buy them a coffee maker or something and maybe take advantage of that.
Yes.
Okay, well, are you going to come back with us, back to us with your best suggestions on the way to go with this?
We will do that, yes.
Okay. Anything else from anybody? Vito, Jaime, do you have something you'd want to add here?
No, I think the purpose of today's agenda item was to kind of recap the year thus far. And I think in closing, Mr. Adornano pointed to the fact that these discussions are continuing and that we do really want to ensure that any dollar that's being put in by the city or UCSB for that matter, or any partners, is being well used and well intentioned for the actual end users, the entrepreneurs, as well as the community as a whole. So I think the report covers really what we wanted to cover today, and then as more information becomes available, I'm sure we could come back to the council and provide that information.
To chime in, Mr. Mayor and Council, I think one of the things that we received a lot of very positive feedback on was this year's event held at Beccaro, where we had all the competing teams present all of their ideas that they had to the community, and people were able to interact, and it was a great opportunity to kind of see what we're talking about, which is having UCSB, the chamber, and the city kind of come together where we're talking about exciting ideas that are happening in the community, that people are trying to grow their business. And it was right here in Goleta, which has made it even more special. So I think that's causing us to really kind of look at, like you would normally, look at what you're doing and see if there are opportunities to make things better and make adjustments in how we're doing it so we can continue the work that you've asked us to do.
All right. That makes a lot of sense. So you spoke of expanding the accelerator program. How do you envision that coming about?
Well, for one, I'd like to make it longer than 7 weeks. And I think we got a little late in the spring in planning it and pulling it together and finding instructors. And so the goal would be to get a little earlier start on that. And if we can keep those teams a little bit longer, and then determining on what their next step is and trying to identify where we can incubate them after that, that would be the goal there. And I think there's naturally, if you have more time, you can expand the scope, because we were limited with what we could cover in a 7 week period of time.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much, Mr. Ardonetto. Anybody else?
Thank you.
All right. Jaime, Vito, thank you for your participation in this. And keep up the good work over there, Dave. You're bringing a fresh look at it for sure. So we appreciate eventually how this may evolve. So thanks.
Thank you.
Now, before we go to the consent calendar, let me just give a shout out to Stuart Kasdan. He's a newly elected member of the City Council, and he will be up here in December. So you want to wave your hand? If you want a cameo for the TV, you might turn around and look at the camera. All right, thank you. All right, I think we are at the consent calendar, Madam Clerk.
Item B1, approval of the City Council meeting minutes of October 3rd, 2016 and November 1st, 2016. B2, acceptance of the October 2016 check register. B3, acceptance of quarterly treasurer's report for the quarter ending September 30th, 2016. B4, City of Goleta legislative platform for calendar year 2017. B5, consultant services agreement with M&S Engineers, Inc. for construction management inspection and materials testing services for the Hollister Avenue Class 1 bike path.
All right. Are there any council members who would like to pull an element of the consent calendar?
I move approval if there's no objections.
Please. Second. Okay. All those in favor of accepting, say aye.
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 Opposed? Passes unanimously. All right, now we're going to move in, which I don't expect to be too contentious, but it should be interesting at least. If you would, Madam Clerk, read our C1.
Initiation of rabbit sales and ownership regulations.
Okay, and we have Winnie Kai to speak to us about this subject, if you would, Ms. Kai.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Council members. Today, I'm here with Jaime Valdez, Economic Development Coordinator from Neighborhood Services, to bring forth an item that Council directed that we bring to agenda, which is to look into the regulation of the sale of rabbits. So we did a little bit of research into the facts of the existing situation, and I will let Mr. Valdez go into that, and then I will follow up with some options for the city.
Once again, Mayor and members of the council, just a little bit of background. So as Ms. Kai brought up, on October 18th, the council requested this item come to the council for consideration and an information briefing. For context, it's important to remember that the city contracts with the County of Santa Barbara's Animal Control Services Division, which is part of their public health department. In regards to rabbits, in the case of abandoned rabbits, they're often turned into the shelter that the Animal Control Services operates over on Overpass Road, and are sheltered through the Bunnies Urgently Needing Shelter, or BUNS, program that co-locates there at that location. Adoptions are handled through the shelter. BUNS provides the educational and coordination assistance with potential adoptees. What's really important to know is that there's only two pet stores that sell pets in Goleta, and only one of them actually sells rabbits. We called and spoke to some of the store managers just to get a better flavor of what actually takes place there. They obtain, the one pet store that actually does obtain rabbits and sells them, they get them from a local, or actually a regional breeder, and they sell on the order of 1 to 2 per month. And actually, when we spoke to them, they didn't even have any that they carried at that time, and they probably wouldn't have any for at least another month or two. So the scale of sales, for all intents and purposes, is about maybe 1 or 2 per month. So you're talking about maybe, you know, 2 dozen per year. According to Animal Services, intakes at the shelter have been trending downward. You'll see in the staff report, going back to fiscal year 12-13, you know, there was a high of 28 in fiscal year 13-14, and since then it's been trending downward to about 14. At last count, they had 6. So the numbers themselves would indicate that the trend is going downward from an already kind of minimal number of bunnies being given up for adoption or being processed through BUNS or the shelters. That being said, I'll turn it over to Ms. Kaya. So some of the options that could be considered by the council in regards to this information.
Thank you, Mr. Valdez. So there are about 4 options for council to take. First of all, is take no action. You have information. If you deem it to be a problem, you have 3 options, and you could sort of do a combination of all the next 3 options. So if the problem of rabbits can be regulated by sales and ownership. So we have 2 pet stores in town, so you can prohibit the sale of non-spayed, non-neutered rabbits. Or you can, cities like LA and San Francisco and San Diego have seen some proliferation in stray rabbits being turned in, so they have prohibited the sale of non-rescue rabbits. So we could take on that tact as well. Thirdly, within our Goleta Municipal Code, we mainly regulate dogs and cats. We require dogs to be licensed and require cats and dogs to get an unaltered license if they're not spayed and neutered. So, and then to note, any adopted dog or cat through a shelter has to be spayed or neutered. So we could do a combination of that and add rabbits to it, require people who have unspayed, unneutered rabbits to obtain an unaltered license. So those are the sort of 3 regulatory ways that we can address it. Prohibit the sale at pet stores, prohibit sale of non-spayed, non-neutered rabbits, prohibit the sale of non-rescue rabbits, or require non-spayed, non-neutered rabbits to get unaltered licenses. And questions?
Is that it?
Yes.
You're done with your presentation?
Yes, I am.
Okay, well, thank you for making the options clear. Council Member Bennett.
Yeah. Under the current regulations, can pet stores sell like cats and dogs that are non-rescue? Do we have any regulation in place? Because I'm aware of other cities that have regulations that say that they can only sell rescued animals.
No, we don't have that in place. We just require that they obtain, the dogs obtain a license.
Okay.
So no prohibition on the sale of non-rescue dogs and cats.
Okay. I'm kind of leaning towards if we decide to pursue an ordinance, that we make the ordinance a bit broader so it applies to the animals in general, cats, dogs, bunnies. I think that's fine. But I wouldn't want to just limit it to bunnies.
Right.
And I know that we've only got 2 pet stores now, but you never know. We could have more pet stores. And I think that would be more important to be proactive on that as an issue. But I do want to hear from the public if we have any speaker slips for people that want to speak on this.
I think we have questions down here, though.
Okay. We'll come back to that about that public comment. If you wish to speak on this subject, please give a speaker slip to Liana, our Madam Clerk there. Okay, if you would, Mr. Aceves.
Thank you. Well, I'm the one that brought this forward, and I have no problem expanding the scope I just wanted to get to the ordinance committee so we can move forward. The buns issue is significant. We have three pet stores, not two. We have PetSmart, Pet House, and Limos. So there's three in town now, and there could be more.
According to Limos, they don't sell pets when I spoke to them. So
okay, but doesn't prohibit them from doing, you know, the comment was we only have two pet stores. We actually have three. And there's nothing prohibiting them from selling bunnies. So that's why this ordinance is very important. In the audience, we have Jean Silva, who runs Buns, and she's a great resource for information on the problem of Buns. And I'll give you some information that she gave me earlier, and hopefully she'll come up and answer any questions you have. They've been neutering rabbits since the 1990s. To neuter a bunny is $250, and it's all handled through the nonprofit. A single breeding pair of rabbits, their offspring, can produce 200 rabbits in 1 year. So that's how important this is. The Buns is also getting rescues from basically throughout the county. And also, incidentally, from a lot of UCSB students that come to school with their bunnies and then no longer want them, and so they end up at Buns. My hope is that, another comment. First of all, 27 of the 72 rabbits that arrived between 2012 and 2014 came from the 93117 area code, and 42% came from the 93105 area code. And there are pet stores that have taken rabbits in. They found rabbits at their back door, abandoned, and they end up selling them. So it's a bigger problem than just, you know, I don't agree with the characterization that we only get one or two bunnies. It's a significant problem. But I would hope that we move this forward to the ordinance committee and express the scope. However, keep it timely so we can bring back soon. So if it's okay with you, I'd love to have Jean Silva come up and answer any questions the council may
have. I have a couple questions, so.
She's got a speaker slip in, okay. So she'll be up in a minute. All right, Mr. Vallejo.
So forgive my ignorance here, but if we were to impose a ban on only, if it's whether it's rabbits or, you know, cats, dogs, and rabbits, and you can only sell rescue animals, how would that affect people that are breeding any one of these animals professionally, for lack of a better term? In other words, you want a purebred, whatever kind of bunny it might be. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the types of bunnies, but or a dog, if you wanted a purebred Dalmatian. I know there's the one place in Cayo Real that they do Dalmatian giveaways every now and then. How would our ban on that work with people who are actually trying to breed a purebred type of animal, if you can only get it from a rescue shelter? Am I catching you off guard? If you need to work on this, that's fine. Basically,
the unaltered license is for breeders.
Okay.
That is for people who, and we require a certificate from a veterinarian saying mm-hmm. that this animal is healthy, it's gotten the vaccinations necessary. And so there is a path for breeders.
They just couldn't buy it from a pet store here in Goleta,
yes.
Probably. I mean, unless they could somehow find a purebred rescue animal, then they could do that, I suppose. But we're limiting our inventory, let's put it that way. Okay.
And we would clarify that in any ordinance that we put forth.
Okay. And to Councilman Aceves' question or point, I mean, these numbers look like they're declining and they're not a huge issue. So do we understand why there's a break between what Councilman Aceves thinks is a, and I'm not saying you're wrong, but I should say what Councilman Aceves hears is a bigger problem than what these numbers seem to reflect. I mean, 14 bunnies, any animal that's out on its own, you know, we all love animals, especially cute little bunnies, but it seems to be not a huge problem here in Goleta.
Yeah, without going too deep into it, I just think these are the numbers that were mm-hmm. brought to our attention. Valuing them as either too high or too low, or just about right is I would think somewhat arbitrary because sure. everyone has their different opinions. But based on the feedback we got from Animal Control, mm-hmm. they didn't, with any real command of tone or voice, say that this is a pressing issue or a problem. What we're getting at, too, is that when we talk to the pet stores locally, Mr. Sevis is correct, there's three pet stores that sell pet supplies, mm-hmm. but actual selling of pets, animals, there was only two, and only one of them did have the bunnies, yeah. and in that case it was very infrequent how often they sold them and when they carried them. So obviously, you know, bunnies and any other animal can go into different zip codes and, mm-hmm. and city limits, and so we don't really have control over what happens in neighboring jurisdictions or people bring them from other places. So based on the information that we have and the insight that we got from the Animal Control Services, mm-hmm. This is the information that we have to base our...
And to clarify, Animal Control gets the bunny and passes it on to Buns. Is that correct? So unless they're, and I'm not saying anybody's wrong. I'm just trying to figure out why there's a breakdown here. Unless there's something going on in the animal shelter that we don't understand, that you should be seeing the same number of bunnies that they are, basically. That's the hope, at least. They're passing them on. Well, maybe you can answer that question when you get to the mic. And also, to Jaime's point, Mr. Valdez, sorry, Jaime, where are people buying bunnies? I guess would be my question to you, too. Maybe you can help us with that, because they're not buying them much here in Goleta. But, you know, Santa Barbara's 5 minutes away, so that doesn't mean anything. But anyway, those are my questions and puzzlements, let's put it that way.
Yeah. Did you want to comment there?
I have comments, but I'll wait.
All right.
I have no question.
Why don't we go to the source here? Gene Silva of Buns is here to tell us about their organization.
Thank you very much. Buns is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we are a completely volunteer group of individuals. And we care for the rabbits that arrive at the Santa Barbara County Stray Animal Shelter. It has been pointed out that we spay and neuter all of the rabbits. We started doing that in the early 90s out of self-defense, if you will. But it does cost a lot of money. We raise $250 per rabbit that is adopted out to pay for spaying and neutering, because there is no low-cost spay-neuter program in Santa Barbara County. And when I talk to people on the phone who have rabbits and are looking to spay and neuter, the sticker price of $250 is a lot of money. And the closest low-cost spay-neuter is down in Ventura County in Oxnard. People get their rabbits from a variety of places. Some of them, sort of the default is to go to pet stores, but sometimes neighbors will give away baby bunnies because there was a little accident and they ended up breeding unintentionally, or maybe because they wanted to. I talked to one lady who had two rabbits, and one of them came from Bakersfield, and another one was given to her by a neighbor who no longer wanted it. And it's that sort of thing that happens with rabbits. I would say we don't really have a big supply problem. There are a lot of rabbits. The total intake in 2013 for the South Coast, that would be everything on the South Coast, excluding Solvang, but Goleta, Santa Barbara, Carpinteria, Montecito, and all the area in between, was 161 rabbits. In 13-14, it was 194. In 14-15, it was 135. And in 15-16, it was 95. So really the problem from our point of view is not rabbits, but the availability, the sale of unspayed, unneutered rabbits. Rabbits, a breeding pair of rabbits, can produce over 200 rabbits in 1 year, the original pair and their offspring. A female rabbit can become pregnant the day that she delivers her litter, and litter sizes are about six. So So you can have a declining population for a number of years, but only one family who has rabbits running loose in their backyard and lets it go for a couple of years can produce a substantial number of rabbits. I went to Reno to assist a number of years ago in the Best Friends Rescue, where they took over 1,000 rabbits out of the backyard of a mobile home. So it can get out of control very, very quickly. We're attempting to work right now with a family in the Montecito area who are allowing their bunnies to breed, and they've given us 3 litters, and we're trying to get the rest of them so we can spay and neuter them. So I would suggest to you that the importance is reducing the number of individual rabbits in any community that are not spayed or neutered. If people get them from the shelter, they are spayed or neutered. If their neighbor gives them an unspayed rabbit to go with their spayed or neutered rabbit, you do not have a problem. But if they get a rabbit from a source that is not spayed or neutered, and that's typically what happens in pet stores, and then someone gives them a rabbit, or a neighborhood rabbit hops or digs into their backyard, then we start to have a problem. And, you know, we've taken, as a county government, not as Buns, but we've taken over 90 rabbits out of one home in Lompoc in the last, I think, 5 years. We still have something like 15 rabbits from a home that gave us like 25 from Santa Barbara 2 years ago. And so it goes. So I would suggest to you that even though the number of rabbits being sold in Goleta is not great, the fact that they're unspayed and unneutered is a significant problem. If we can sell or adopt more spayed or neutered rabbits, then you're not going to have an uncontrolled population explosion. And so that's why we would support not selling rabbits in pet stores, and why we would support selling spayed and neutered rabbits in pet stores if they were going to sell them. Did I answer your questions? Yes.
No.
Thank you.
Is it easy to tell if a rabbit has been spayed and neutered?
It's very easy to tell if a male rabbit has been neutered. It's not very easy to tell if a female rabbit has been spayed.
Okay.
Actually, I do have one question.
All right, Mr. Vallejo.
And I think I know the answers, but so you said there was last year and the year before about 125 rabbits were brought to your facility, or Buns took care of about 125 rabbits.
We received 135 in 2014-15. And 95 in 15-16.
Okay. So the vast majority aren't coming from Goleta then?
I would rely on the staff report. Yeah. We get information based on zip codes.
Sure.
And so I would hope that the county is keeping good records for the animals that they're charging you for. So okay. I rely on them.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Gene, yeah. I have one question, if I could. The recommendations that are in our staff report, the first one is obviously take no action, but one is impose a ban on the sale of non-spayed or non-neutered rabbits. And then the third one is impose a ban on the sale of non-rescue rabbits. Which one would Buns be in favor of, or would be a combination of both?
Well, I think we would be in favor of a ban on the sale of non-spayed or non-neutered rabbits. I think rescue rabbits, you know how laws go, probably better than the average citizen. You write a law, and then depending on the definitions in the law, it can have an effect that you may not anticipate. You can rescue and rehome a rabbit that has not been spayed or neutered. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of kill shelters down in the Los Angeles area that are not necessarily spaying or neutering rabbits. And so you could have a pet store go to Los Angeles or maybe up to Slo County and pick up rescue rabbits that are not spayed and neutered, and then you still have the same challenge that those rabbits, if improperly managed, could present over time a significant nuisance if they breed.
All right. Anybody else like to comment? Council Member Perotti.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I don't have any questions, but thank you for giving us those numbers. Well, I did a little research over the weekend myself because I just felt like I needed to get some more information, and it's true. Limos, they don't sell any live animals, and PetSmart only does adoptable dogs, cats, and rabbits. Pet House does have one rabbit right now and a waiting list. So I'm just looking at, I'm leaning more in favor of option three. And I agree with Councilmember Bennett that I would like to see it not such a narrow ordinance that's more broad, that would look at cats and dogs from rescues. Yes, there is a law that all animals, it's a state law called the Vincent's Laws, and it was passed in 1992, that all animals passing through official rescues and shelters must be spayed or neutered before being adoptable. So that could be something that I would think would be put into the ordinance, that that's made very clear so the pet stores would know that. 170 cities nationwide have ordinance banning the sale of dogs, cats, and rabbits at their pet stop shops right now. And I guess a lot of the ordinance vary. I didn't look at all of them. I looked at several, and I looked at Los Angeles ordinance. It seemed to be the cleanest out of all the ordinances. San Diego was okay as well. So I just think that staff, has this opportunity, if my colleagues agree, to broaden the scope of this ordinance and then be a leader with the state and national trend, and maybe others will follow suit on this one. So, that's where I'm coming from. I think there is a need, but I would just like to see us not waste this opportunity, a wasted opportunity to broaden it for cats and dogs as well.
All right. Well, let me comment on that for a second. Council Member or Mayor Pro Tem Vallejo brought up the economic impact of what we're doing here, and is there one? Well, it's obvious it's not much on the pet house or other people who do this thing. Dogs and cats, I don't know about that, and breeders as well. Is there an economic impact? What I would favor here in this discussion is to limit the ban to rabbits for the moment, and then charge you with, or charge somebody on staff who could take a look into it to see if there is an economic impact here, so that we don't have breeders, perhaps. I don't know if we even have any breeders in Goleta. We certainly might. But and some people will want to buy an animal to breed it outright. So anyway, that's where I would be coming from here. I'm okay with the rabbits, but if we expand it, I'm not opposed to expanding it. I just don't know what the effect of doing that might be. Yeah.
Well, if we're starting deliberations, then I guess I would be, especially since the expert, and I guess you're the expert, certainly know more about bunnies than I do, that's for sure. I would go with her recommendation, which would be number two. I'm not sure how much of a effect it's going to have, only because we don't sell a lot of rabbits inside of city limits. I'm not, because it's not important, but if we think it'll help, and it doesn't seem like an issue right now inside of city limits, but it could be. I think, and that's what this is more focused on than the problem today here in Goleta, because the numbers are not overwhelming yet, but if we think that could address a future problem, then and again, I'll defer to your expertise. I think we should go with number two then, and I can't imagine the economic development of two rabbits a month really killing the pet house, whoever sells the rabbits, or even, and it doesn't forbid it. It just means they have to make sure, actually just means they'll go to the shelter probably, right, and get a couple of spayed or neutered rabbits on somebody else's dime and sell those instead. So that would be my suggestion.
Other comments? Or, yeah, council member Aceves.
Well, I think to move this forward, I think if we created an ordinance based on the bunnies and craft such an ordinance that that precludes selling them from pet shops, that's what we're talking about, we can use that as a template for future issues if we're going to look at dogs or cats or whatnot. But, you know, and everybody knows this, bunnies are really cute when they're little babies, and they get them right around Easter time. And then they get too big to handle, and they get released. And that's what we're trying to preclude from happening. So my hope is we can pass an ordinance in the city that other communities will copy and preclude the sale of bunnies from the pet shops. So if we need a motion, I'd love to make the motion to refer this to the ordinance committee to have item 2 further vetted for an ordinance to come back to the council.
Did you want to comment, or are you seconding that?
Not seconding yet.
Okay.
But I wanted to inquire of staff a question that, since we're having this conversation, and I guess, Winnie, I'm going to ask you the question.
Yes.
When you're developing an ordinance, does it make more sense to include the items that ultimately you want to include, or just go ahead with what's being proposed today, leaving out the dogs and cats?
This type of ordinance, it would not be difficult to be inclusive, and because our animal ordinance does not specifically only address one type of animal. So it wouldn't really matter to us either way to develop it for something small to begin with and then later on add some words to it, or start broad and have you guys narrow as we bring it back to you for consideration.
Okay. Well, I still believe having a broader ordinance, it solves a bunch of problems on the front end. It makes it ultimately easier, and it's going to go to the ordinance committee where we typically try to flesh those things out before we bring it back to council in any case. So.
Yeah, Councilmember Perotti.
Might this go back with a recommendation to the ordinance committee to look at a broader scope here, and then maybe come back with the question about potentially who is this financially hurting? The problem with seeing a lot of dogs and cats, well, especially puppies in pet stores, are their puppy mills that are happening. Typical breeders usually don't sell. I've not known too many professional breeders to sell in pet stores. They sell privately. So that's always the concern, is the puppy mills that's happening. So even though I support something being done, I would still like to look at a broader scope. So this is not a missed opportunity at this point. So that's where I'm coming from.
I would be willing to amend my motion to include dogs and cats, but limit it to the sales from pet shops.
Well,
second that.
Are we talking about banning sales of rabbits, or are we talking about non-sprayed and non-neutered rabbits?
Banning the sale of bunnies from pet shops.
Oh, well, I couldn't support that. I mean, I think our executive director, I think it's executive director, is that right? No? Well, you are today.
Member of the board.
Well, I'm promoting you today. Suggested that even just making sure the animals were sprayed and neutered was sufficient. So, I mean, it seems overkill to just ban it if we think it's okay to make sure they're sprayed and neutered.
That's an enforcement issue. Are we going to go in and check the bunny to see if those, before they sell it, they'll spay and neuter? Most of these pet shops, especially in Santa Barbara, have bunnies turned into them and they sell them, literally overnight.
But if they have to get them from a shelter where it's a law and it's put into our ordinance that they come from a shelter that's required to spay and neuter them before they can go to a rescue, mm-hmm, or a shelter, then we eliminate that problem.
And furthermore, if someone shows up at a pet store with a bunny, they can say, take it to the shelter. And then they can get it later and sell it. I just, why are we tying the hands of commerce? Why are we saying you can't sell it if we think it's sufficient to make sure they're sprayed and neutered? Let's let these businesses do business and make sure, as long as the animals aren't being abused.
But the realistic, people are not going to spay their bunnies. They're not going to spend $250 to spay their bunnies. Mm-hmm. The pet shops aren't going to go get a rescue and sell it and force a nonprofit who's already paid the $250. They're not going to return the investment to the nonprofit. The idea is that we shouldn't have to take a bunny and have to have the nonprofit spay it. Our hope is that we get to a point that they are already spayed and we're to eliminate the problem. So I think we have enough to go through and just look at the various options, and then let's vet it out through the ordinance committee, and we can figure out what works, what doesn't work, have a public meeting on it, let the pet shops come, let Buns come, and let's fine-tune something that makes sense. But I certainly don't want to waste any time on it. I want to move it forward as quickly as possible.
So my understanding is that we'll leave it open-ended, that we're not deciding on two or three, but let the ordinance committee flesh it out.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Well, I may just say here, this may be the last time I will inveigh on this subject here. I agree with Mayor Pro Tem Vallejo. We want to make sure there are no unintended consequences here. So I'm sure, Ms. Kai, when you're examining this, you'll try to determine whether anybody's being hurt by this. But at the very least, we come out with an ordinance that says that only animals that are spayed and neutered can be sold in Goleta, and that should more or less answer the key objection of Buns. So anyway, that's my feeling on it. Does anybody else want to comment before we vote on this? Nope. Okay. Anybody want to make a motion?
I do.
Oh, you do? And we have a second?
Yeah.
Okay, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? No? Okay, it passes unanimously. Okay, we have moved C2 on the parking zones on Ward Drive to this evening. So if you would, Madam Clerk, would you read us C3?
Fiscal year 16-17, first quarter financial review.
Mr. Mayor, before we start, if we could announce again what C2 is, which is the restricted parking zones for Ward Drive. We're dealing with that tonight, not now.
Didn't I say that?
You just said the item number, but there may be some, and I don't know, just turn the speaker slip. I don't know if that's on the parking or not.
All right. Okay.
Okay, Mayor and Council members, we have Luke Rio, our accounting manager, who is going to lead the presentation on the 2016-17 first quarter financial review. And after he concludes his presentation, both Luke and I will be available for any questions that Council may have.
All right, good afternoon, Mayor and members of the City Council. I'm here today to present the fiscal year 2016-17 first quarter financial review, quarter ending September 30th, 2016. The slide right here before you presents an overview of our general fund. Our original budget as adopted is at $24.7 million. Our current budget stands at $27 million, which this contains carryovers and encumbrances from prior fiscal year. I'll get more into detail in that in later slides. This slide here represents shows our general fund revenues as adopted and shows our percentages-wise how much revenue our revenue source represents of the total adopted general fund revenues. Our three largest revenue categories include transient occupancy tax at 34%, sales tax at 26%, and property tax at 24%. This next slide here shows the prior year comparison year-to-date actuals through the first quarter. As you can see, overall revenues are tracking as expected. There are increases, slight increases, in comparison to last year, most noticeably in the transient occupancy tax. Just as a reminder, property tax is normally received in December, April, and June, so you can see why that's still like a lower amount. Overall revenues are tracking as expected at 13.5% of total budget, similar to last year. And below, you can see the tax revenue budget variances, as I explained earlier, that the three big taxes are represented there and are tracking as expected. And you can easily see that the transient occupancy tax has a slight growth, and it's tracking with our original growth estimates of 3%. So property tax is trending as per prior year to date percentages. Sales tax is trending in line with prior year. And transient occupancy tax is tracking with original growth estimates of 3%. And franchise fees is tracking with budgeted amounts and is consistent with prior year. It is important to note, though, that sales tax no longer includes the two semi-annual payments for property tax in lieu of sales tax, also known as the triple flip, that ended in 2015-16. Another large revenue source of ours includes licenses and service charges. They are currently way above the 25% budget to actual target. This is primarily due to higher than anticipated building activity. Those top three categories that are exceeding the quarter mark are building permits, plan check fees, and public works deposits earned. This table displays the budget to actual comparisons and also shows the comparison to prior as well. And as a total, you can see on the bottom right, percentage of budget to date is 46.5% compared to last year's prior year, 27.6%. Other revenue categories, they are tracking as expected, and they are under budget due to timing of revenues. Some of the categories this includes are reimbursements. CIP reimbursement activity is below budget, mostly due to project timing and available staff for grant cost recovery. Other revenues, this includes motor vehicle license fees and state mandate reimbursements and other miscellaneous revenues. Motor vehicle license fees are normally received during the second quarter. Transfers in from other funds, currently revenues received to date of $7,877 represents reimbursements for CDBG staff time. A majority of these revenues will be received based on the timing of our development impact fee nexus study. This slide then presents the comparison of budget to actuals, what we just mentioned on the other revenue categories. And you can see as of today, 7.6% has been received compared to the total of 11.3% of last fiscal year. Now we are getting into our general fund expenditures. Our total general fund expenditures adopted or currently adopted is $27 million. This pie chart displays the percentages of departments of that make up that $27 million. This next chart shows the year-to-date actuals through the first quarter. The overall expenditures are tracking as expected. It is higher in comparison to last year in one of the departments, primarily due to expenditures for support to other agencies were being processed in the first quarter. Overall expenditures are tracking as expected at 18.5% of budget. Original budget as adopted was $24.7 million on June 7, 2016. Since then, it has been revised for carryovers and encumbrances of $2.3 million for a total of $27 million. The carryover and encumbrances is addressed in more detail in the staff report and it also reflects the additional appropriation of $40,000 approved by City Council on October 3rd for the Goleta Union School District Crossing Guard Program. The department budget variances have been evaluated, and there is additional appropriations requested, which I will address at the end of the slide. Again, this next slide breaks out the departments and displays year-to-date actual comparisons. Currently, year-to-date percentage of budget, 18.5%, compared to last year, percent of budget at 17.8%. This next slide represents our projected reserve activity for our fund balance. Our fiscal year 2015-16 ending balance was at $18.3 million, and we're projected for a ending fund balance for 2016-17 at $16.8 million. The revenue neutrality agreement, the city allocates funding to the County of Santa Barbara for sales tax at 30% of the 1% revenues, and property tax is shared equally. Estimated currently for fiscal year 2016-17 is $5.6 million, which sales tax makes up $2.9 million, property tax makes up $2.7 million. To put this in perspective, the $5.6 million is approximately 20.6% of our total general fund operating budget. Historical payments cumulative projected through 2016-17 equals $103.4 million. This next slide is a table that breaks down the total contributions for the revenue neutrality agreement. And again, you can see the total on the bottom is $103.4 million. Other funds have been evaluated. The staff report includes an attachment that shows a comparison of budget versus actuals for all funds that can be found in attachment 3. Any deficit fund balances for grant funds is due to pending reimbursements currently in process. Our gas tax fund revenues received to date of $163,000 is on target at 25% of the $640,000 budgeted. Measure A, 9.5% of the $1.5 million budget has been received as of quarter end. First three payments are tracking as expected at 25% of the total budgeted amounts. Capital Improvement Program. The CIP summary by project has been reviewed for adequate funds and can be seen in detail on attachment 4 of the staff report. No, at this time, there is no recommended CIP adjustments. For the general fund, staff is recommending budget adjustments as a result of higher than anticipated building activity in the city. As you can see in the table before you, we are asking for an increase in two revenue accounts with another offsetting increase in the two expenditure accounts. Adequate funds are available for the requested appropriations, as increased revenues will offset the expenditures. Any questions?
Are there questions?
Let me just note that Luke and I met with our finance committee on November 4th. They reviewed not only the treasurer's report, but also this first quarter report as well, just so you're aware.
All right. Where did you grow up?
Hanford, California.
I'm sorry, where?
Hanford, California.
Mm-hmm. Were you astounded by these RNA numbers?
Yes.
I mean, everybody is who sees it, everybody but the Board of Supervisors. If you would, when you practice this before you read it, try and get a little more indignation in your voice when you're doing the RNA stuff, because we've been incensed up here forever about it. Tony, do you tell me
I would just,
word on
yeah,
it.
This will be my last chance, so it's a shame you and I won't be here to continue that. You know, but we'll be free on Tuesday, so maybe we should go to the County Board of Supervisors meeting. I'm sure Ms. Wolf and Ms. Hartman would love to see us there discussing what they do with our $5 million a year.
Yeah, I'm going to ask Congressman Carbajal, as he rides off into the sunset, to do us right before he leaves.
He's got nothing to lose at this point. Thank you, Luke. Great job. We, you know, yeah, Paul and excuse me, Councilman Perotti and I said, Paul, I'm getting too familiar. Looked at this, and you did a great job presenting this to us, and it's comforting to see that the city's numbers are still in good shape and will be. And as far as the budget adjustment goes, obviously that's kind of a wash. We make 30% on it, basically, right? So yeah. That's fine. It just means that there's more activity in planning and building permits and things. So good job. Thanks.
Did you want to comment, Rob?
Just one comment, and I want to thank you for stepping in. Great report. And you got a handle on the finances very quickly, so it's very reassuring. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're
ready to make the motion. Oh, I'm sorry.
I just wanted to thank you as well, and thank you for our ad hoc or our finance and audit committee meeting, and you presented the facts, and it was very clear, and thank you so much. Thank you for your report.
Oh, yeah. Councilmember Bennett.
Well, are we ready for a resolution?
I think we are. I think we're, I think Tony was jumping at the bit on
that. Yeah, I know. I was excited.
No.
Okay. Well,
go ahead.
I don't, okay. I wasn't sure if you were going to do it. I move that we adopt resolution number 16, next in order, entitled a resolution of the City Council of the City of Goleta, California, amending the city's operating and CIP budget for the fiscal year 2016-17.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, it passes unanimously. Okay, that brings us to C4, if you would, Madam Clerk.
Item C4, reservation of emergency shelter transitional housing beds for Goleta homeless.
Mayor and council members, I wanted to call to your attention that our senior project manager, Claudia Dado, prepared this report. She was unable to present, which she let me know a number of weeks ago. She had a pre-planned obligation. So I'm happy to present this on her behalf. There may be questions that if I can't answer, some of the members of the audience can answer. I see that we have a few folks here to come and speak to this item. And Councilmember Perotti may also have a thing or two she wants to add. But I'll give a brief background and just remind Council that it was back on September 6th that Council requested that an item come back to them discussing the possibility of contracting with the Salvation Army Hospitality House to continuously reserve one or possibly more shelter beds for occupancy by homeless individuals from the Goleta area. To put that in context, for at least the past 9 months, the city has been hosting weekly meetings of the Goleta Coordinated Outreach Team, which is kind of a subset of C3H. And the group has met here in City Hall numerous times, occasionally meets at the marketplace as well. And the group is facilitated by Luke Barrett, who is a regional coordinator with C3H. We do have Mr. Chuck Flax in the audience representing C3H. One part of the overall mission of this team is to connect people who are experiencing homelessness, specifically in Goleta, with permanent housing, and also to provide them with intensive case management. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of where their focus is and the issues that they're grappling with. One of those challenges is that in Goleta, and even in the Goleta Valley, there is no emergency shelters or housing specifically set aside for homeless clients. So the idea came about through discussions of that group to reserve shelter beds in nearby areas in the city of Santa Barbara for specific clients that come out of the Goleta area. But this concept isn't entirely new. As is noted in the staff report, the city of Santa Barbara has been doing this through their restorative police program, and the county has also reserved beds through various departments such as probation and behavioral wellness. In addition, the Veterans Administration is funding 8 beds that are reserved for veterans. Back in August, on the 23rd, a group from the city, which included Claudia Dado, our senior deputy, Dave Valadez, Councilmember Prody, and myself, toured the Salvation Army's Hospitality House in Santa Barbara and PATH, which was formerly known as Casa Esperanza Homeless Shelter. Both of these organizations provide similar services such as case management, counseling, life skills, vocational training, and assistance in finding permanent housing. After several hours touring both facilities, the group unanimously felt like the Salvation Army offered the most supportive and comprehensive program, and we all really were very impressed by the facility, by the staff, by the services and amenities that they provide. At this point, as far as I know, this number is still accurate, but Councilmember Prody can correct me if there's been a change here, but the Goleta Coordinated Outreach Team has been actively working with 5 chronically or recently homeless individuals in Goleta that may be good candidates for taking the next step into a shelter program. They haven't been able to move anyone into a shelter because of a lack of funding, but they do have individuals that they think are ready to make that step. So what's before you today is whether or not, as council, you want to consider reserving one or more beds with the Salvation Army Hospitality House. And also, just to give you a little bit more context, the recommended approach would be that these individuals would be referred to the shelter after the outreach team has identified them and worked with them and gotten a commitment that they are ready to go into a shelter. So that this program would still be led by that outreach team if the city wants to go ahead and reserve beds. A little more detail on the hospitality house. When we took our tour, we learned that the cost of reserving one bed for an entire year is right around $13,000 per bed, which breaks down to about $35 per night. This cost includes meals and case management, counseling, life skills coaching, vocational training, financial mentoring, recreation and therapy, health services, and veterans assistance. So it's very comprehensive. In discussions with Ms. Dado, she mentioned that one potential source of funding for reserving shelter beds could be CDBG, and within that grant program, specifically the public services category. If council wants to move forward with further exploring reservation of shelter beds, staff could return with more detailed information about the Salvation Army Hospitality House program, a draft agreement between the city and the Salvation Army, and a more complete analysis of the revenue sources, the fiscal impacts for funding the beds on a one-time or ongoing basis. So what we've given you here is just a very brief look into this to give you hopefully enough information to determine if you want to move forward with deeper discussions and decision making at a later point. So all that right. Concludes what I had to say, but certainly I welcome others to add to what I've already presented.
Well, we'll get something here definitive from Councilmember Perotti in a second. Is there anybody who'd like to ask a question of our city manager? Well, I will ask a question. It wasn't clear to me, perhaps I didn't read it carefully enough, that one family might go in here. Do we have something in mind like 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, that someone would stay there?
My understanding is that the referrals would be for individual persons only, not families.
Okay.
And the amount of time an individual would spend in the program wouldn't necessarily be the same for each person. So we have a representative from the Salvation Army Hospitality House here who can speak to this a little bit more. But what we heard on our tour is that the time varies. Some individuals are a great fit for the program. They go through successfully, and within a relatively short period of time, they're into permanent housing. In other cases, it takes a little bit longer. And of course, sometimes there's individuals that are not a good fit and their stay isn't as long. So it does depend on the dynamics and the needs of the individuals involved.
All right. Now, you're the gentleman from the hospitality house. Isn't it a fact that you...
Come up the podium.
I'm sorry?
Oh, yeah, okay.
Now, isn't it part of your design that people stay there a certain length of time and then you more or less ease them out?
Yes, one of our goals is to, as individuals come into the program, our goal is not to keep them forever and ever. We want to transition them out into our goal is permanent housing as soon as possible. They might be renting, they may be on subsidized, or they may be going into a higher level of care due to mental illness or other issues. So our goal is to transition people out as soon as possible. In regards to the length of time, the average stay is 6 months. You know, people do sometimes leave earlier, sometimes through, for example, with restorative court. Sometimes we're just a safe haven until they can get into a program. Let's say they have to stabilize, and that's what our first 30 days of our program is stabilize mentally, physically, you know, get their feet underneath them. And from there, it's are they job ready? If not, we're going to try to work with them vocational skills. If the goal is to possibly go into one of the Salvation Army drug and alcohol rehabilitation programs or even the rescue mission local in Santa Barbara, then we coordinate that. So it's a warm handoff and they're in a better situation than when they came to us.
All right. So you would administer it for us. If we had the bed, the people that came in and out, would you be the administrator on that?
Yes, sir. I'm the executive director. I have staff underneath me that coordinate intake, do the case management. There's counselors, but yes, I would be the individual, the coordinator with Luke or the county or city.
All right, good. Now, comments? Yeah, council member said it.
If we just start for a clerk, what's your name? I'm sorry.
My name is Mark Geisler. I'm the executive director for the Salvation Army.
Thank you. She's going to be researching the tape later to figure out we didn't get your name. I really appreciate the work you do. I'm very familiar with it. I've sent a lot of clients there through the years. But I want to pick up on some of the city managers and just for clarification. Of the people we have in Goleta, they would be welcome to your facility right now.
Yes.
But by partnering with you in this contract, we are saying hold a seat for a potential Goleta that may need a place to go to.
Very true.
Okay, and if we don't have someone to send, how do we handle that?
One of the things that, may I add something to that before I answer your question?
Sure.
One of the benefits, too, is that, and I'll compare it to restorative court, Luke and his team are out there outreaching to folks, and they're building relationships with them, kind of like the restorative court do in Santa Barbara, and so it's not... Luke and the team wouldn't just be dropping someone off at the shelter and having nothing to do. There would still be that collaboration together to make sure that the needs of this individual are met. And I see that the same way. To go back to your question, what would be happening to the bed if it wasn't being used, there would be dialogue with the city manager or whoever my point of contact is and say, how would you like to use this bed to utilize because it's not being utilized right now.
I guess my question is, first of all, I agree we should use CDBG money for this because that's appropriate. We have monies that are specifically set aside for this kind of program. But I guess my question is trying to figure out whether it should be a reimbursement
or a ongoing contractual, knowing that we're not, that we may not have a client. Because we have them in Goleta and they may not want to participate, do we still pay for it as a concern? I'd love to have it where we have identified people that need it and go there, and we can do it as a reimbursement that will cover the cost for that individual. And I think that's maybe something that gets played with as we move forward with what kind of agreement makes sense using our taxpayer dollars. But I'm in support of having some research done as far as how we can do it and how we can pay for it.
All right, other comments? Council Member Bennett.
Yeah. Madam Manager, my question is, what do we use the funding that would come out of CDBG? What's that funding going for specifically now?
I believe that Ms. Dado mentioned that funding is the funding that we have used typically in the past to provide grants to some of the other social services programs. I thought to ask her the question because I know there's a portion of those funds that we've used for infrastructure projects, and she went back and verified that the monies from CDBG that we use for CIP projects, for example, would not be eligible for this program, but it would be the other portion of money that has funded the other social services programs in the past.
Well, that's my question, because obviously if we redirect the money, then the social programs we've been supporting will either have no money or we'll have to provide it from another source if we're still to agree to provide funding.
That's correct. And the likely other source is, of course, the general fund.
I thought so.
God bless the general fund. Okay. Council Member, or actually, Mayor Pro Tem Vallejo.
Either way, call me Tony. So families would be handled separately. Homeless families, sounds like, because I think, Ms. Green, you mentioned that this program isn't really designed for families right now.
Correct. I asked that question when we were on our tour, and the indication was that this facility is devoted toward individuals and not family groups, okay, typically.
So there's separate programs in the community somewhere for, I'm assuming, for homeless families instead?
There is a location called Transition House.
Oh, of course.
And one of the things, one of the changes in funding too, which is, don't know if I have time to get into that much detail, but a lot of the like homeless families, the priority is for rapid rehousing, mm-hmm, to get them into housing as opposed to putting them into an institution.
Sure.
So, I mean, the main place in Santa Barbara is the Transition House.
Okay. And last question, I guess, would be, would there be a way through this funding and everything else to prioritize veterans? Could we make it a preference? I mean,
we didn't ask that question, but I think it's something that in further developing a program we could ask and we could explore that. Okay. But, you know, I would rely heavily on the input from C3H, and I think in order to achieve the goals, it would be important to look at the individuals who've been identified in Goleta, so that we don't create a program that inadvertently excludes the population,
right,
we're trying to.
No,
to,
I guess
to work with.
No, certainly not. I wouldn't want the bed to sit empty just because we couldn't find a veteran.
Right.
But if it came down to it, I think most people would want a preference for a veteran, somebody who served our country, and we should be helping them as well.
Yes.
So.
All right. Well, we actually have someone sitting on the city council who has dedicated a good portion of her civic life to the homeless question. So, Councilmember Perotti, if you would tell us what your take is on all of this.
Well, thank you, Mayor, and thank you, Ms. Green, for a great report, filling in for Claudia. That was well done. I just have to thank all the folks that are here today for coming, and I know you want to speak to it. We have quite a dedicated, small but dedicated group of volunteers, and I see a couple of them in the audience now. And we, over the last, 5 months, 6 months now, it hasn't been that long, have identified and are working with six homeless people. And out of those six, I can tell you three are ready to go. They definitely could use shelter. Because what the frustration, I think, well, let me step back a little bit. What we've been doing, working with the folks that we have identified with the help of Senior Deputy Valadez, so we're helping them find out what they need. And many of them just need, well, they all need shelter, but they also need help getting their ID. Many of them have lost their ID. They need help accessing a post office box so that their mail can come to them. We've secured a location in Old Town that's helping us with that. And then we have volunteers that have gone out actively and helped them get SSI or Social Security. And we have public health that's working with us to identify their health needs. The frustrating part about all of this is that we can't ticket and arrest our way out of this. We're just moving them around, and we're not even moving them around. They get cited, they get ticketed, and then they move, and then we have to find them. So there is truly, truly a need to have some place for them to go. And we were so impressed with Salvation Army and the structure, and you have so much to offer there. And that's why I'm coming to the council for this discussion on moving this forward and looking at identifying funding. Maybe it's not CDBG, but looking at how we can identify funding, because we have tried to place some of the folks that we're working with in different locations, and there's just not an opening. So I think the only way to go is to have a reserved bed. But the important thing that we all feel as part of this committee is that we know the folks that we're working with. We've been working with them for months and earning their trust and getting to know what they need. We would like to definitely be the ones, because we want them to be successful. We know who's ready to go to the Salvation Army. And I think what I understand is that we are committed as a case management, helping with that transition and then staying with those people for at least 18 months. So it's a small, dedicated group of volunteers and that are doing an outrageous amount of work. And the frustration is that we there's no place for them to go. So, you know, I'm sure many are here, a couple are here today, and Luke wasn't able to be here, but he does lead this group and does a great job. We do meet weekly at the marketplace, and we have meetings here monthly. And the monthly meetings are broader. There's more stakeholders that work with us from the housing authority, and the county is involved a little bit. And so I'm hoping that we can figure this out together and see what we can do with these folks.
If there are no further comments from council, we'll open it to some people who wish to comment on this issue. Irene Russo.
I've lived in Goleta 40 years, so I have something to say about the situation. First of all, I would like to say that the city of Los Angeles just passed a bond for $1.2 billion for homeless shelters, and their projection is 10,000 units, actually 18,000 units. So this is not a great deal of money, but I've been personally, I came across the homeless situation. I live on Elwood Station Road, and there seem to be a lot of people that like to hang out there. And there was a man named Samson. I have to talk about this guy. He was sleeping on the street for a month, and he got his car towed by the University of California police, and then he got thrown in jail. But the reason he was from Israel, and he was an officer. He was a lieutenant in the Israeli army. The reason he was sleeping on the street is because he was given a ticket by the University of California Police. For what reason, I don't know. Probably he was fighting with them to keep his car. He spent his whole life saving money for this car that got towed and then eventually impounded, and he lost it. So he slept in the street to wait to go to court. And he went to court. He got the ticket dismissed, but he's had to sleep on the street for a month to get to court. And then the day after he went to court, all his belongings, which kind of took over a lot of the street, which is what got people upset, he took it all. He left town and he went to Pomona. So that broke my heart, because here's this man sleeping on the street. The police are arresting him every night or harassing him. And that was my first encounter with homelessness. My time's up.
30 seconds.
Oh, okay. 30 seconds. Anyway, I've been working with the GH3 group. It's not something that I would ever think that I would get involved with, but I go into homeless camps, I take people out, I take them to the doctor, I take them to the dentist, and it's just amazing how many homeless people are in Goleta and how many camps there are that people don't know about. There are three people that I think would be great candidates for this shelter. One person is temporarily holed up in a tent, but I mean, there are people that are living on the ground in Goleta in different areas because there's a lot of space to do that. So I guess I'm just here to say, I think it's just scratching the surface having three beds in the Salvation Army. I think we need to do a lot more. I think that the Pescadero Lofts is a new paradigm for homelessness and should be considered by Goleta at some point. Anyway, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Lisa Cuss, is it? Coos. Excuse me.
I'm one of the volunteers that Paula was speaking of earlier, and I've been working with the 3CH team now for about 6 months. And I've been remarkably impressed with what the group represents and how much I've learned. And I've worked very closely with one of the individuals that I believe is one of the three that we think is ready. And it's become very clear to me that there are homeless people that are needing and wanting to not be homeless anymore. And those are the ones that the outreach team has identified that we need to work with right now. We need to work with those that we believe are going to be the great successes. And we've identified what we think those are. And as Paula said, they need help in navigating becoming not homeless anymore. They need help getting IDs. They need help getting a post office box so that their ID can be mailed to them. They need help going through applications to get income that they're eligible for. They need help getting medical community put together underneath them. They need all kinds of support besides just getting them not being homeless anymore. It's the whole picture that is really important for them. And right now we are at a complete precipice with these three individuals that we've done everything that we can for them, and there's no place for them to go. So the Salvation Army facility that was toured, I was not able to do that, but I understand that it was quite impressive. I can only urge you that we need this so desperately for these individuals that are ready now and the ones that are going to be ready coming behind them that we are working with. One bed isn't enough, two beds isn't enough, three beds isn't enough. We need as many beds as you can dig as deep into the pockets of the city to provide so that we can get these people to successfully navigate not being homeless anymore. I know they can do this with us standing next to them along the way, and you giving them the opportunity would be amazing for the efforts that are being put forth by the 3CH organization and the team that is supporting them. They're struggling individuals, and they're there for lots of different reasons. The reasons don't really matter. It's what matters is they don't want to be there anymore, and we need to help them not be there anymore. And a place for them to go is the last step that we need until we can get them permanent housing. Please, please, please help. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Coos. Chuck Flax.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Council. Chuck Flax with C3H. I'm the Executive Director. Luke Barrett works for me. And first of all, thank you for your ongoing support of C3H. I think you would agree that for $5,000 a year, you're getting more than your money's worth in terms of helping to coordinate and align services that help homeless people in Goleta. Luke and I and Jeff Schaefer came up with this concept of coordinated outreach teams in response to some of the criticism that we'd gotten from various elected officials around the county that they weren't seeing results of kind of higher level coordination that we were doing on a monthly basis. And huge thanks to Councilmember Perotti for putting together and supporting volunteers who are doing the work that ideally government officials, you know, and some would say the county ought to do it, some would say the city ought to do it, who go down to the level of the streets and actually work hand in hand and case manage people off the streets. Many small cities around the nation have for 40 years thought that they could arrest their way out of the problem. Let's move people along. And these aren't necessarily Goleta residents anyway. And all of our research and the work of our coordinated outreach team have shown that, in fact, there is a core group of Goleta residents, many of whom have lived on the streets for many years, who need help. And as you've heard from the volunteers, it's a problem that's growing. Now, we're going to come back to you in February and present data on the point in time count that we'll conduct in January that will say specifically how many Goleta residents, in fact, are homeless and who has lived here for longer than a year as a homeless resident of Goleta. We'll be able to present that data to you. What I commend Paula and the rest of the volunteers for is that they're taking this problem, they're out in front of the problem and trying to case manage people who are currently chronically homeless and getting them the needed housing. The other piece that's very interesting about this model, and I only recently learned of it, I knew our coordinated outreach effort was to focus on locally providing solutions. So ideally getting people into housing in the communities where they're residing. For many reasons, Goleta suffers from a lack of very low-income affordable housing. Pescadero Lofts is full. That's the ideal solution, and we would love to see more of those around the county. Shelters are often a stopgap, but what's happened nationally, including Salvation Army included, is shelters are moving towards this solution-focused approach. So if Goleta moves forward with this, you're really setting a trend, I think, for small cities in partnering with existing resources and finding solutions to homelessness that are long-term, that include employment and permanent affordable housing and supportive services. So you have an opportunity, I think, here to start something that could be very exciting throughout the South Coast. And I'm happy to answer any other questions about C3H's involvement. If I could have 10 more seconds, I do have a concern that you go down this road without professional case management. It may not be sustainable. So something we learned in Santa Barbara when we were doing this as a volunteer effort is that we eventually needed to dedicate a staff person. It was a much larger problem. We're currently case managing 22 people in Santa Barbara, but it's a difficult and time-consuming effort. And so I have a full-time case manager who runs the coordinated outreach team in Santa Barbara. I'm not proposing today that you look at that for C3H or any other agency, because two or three people may be manageable by volunteers. But it's something to consider going forward. If you find that this is a larger problem, and it may well be, to start thinking about how you want to structure that with either request for proposals for service provision, going to the county for additional funding to support case management on the ground. This model that's being developed is really bare bones and volunteer at this point. And so the question becomes how you want to structure this going forward. And we're here every step of the way with you to advise and support and if necessary, do the work. So, and we thank you for your support.
Thank you, Mr. Flax. Mark, did you want to final words?
I just wanted to say thank you. It's always good to hear good things about the agency you work for, and so I extend the invitation of from the C3H volunteers to as well as the council and the mayor. If there's ever a desire to take a tour of our facility, I've worked with Chuck before from C3H. Wonderful man, wonderful agency. So I thank you very much for considering this. So that's all. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for coming down and telling us about the program. So we could deliberate right now if someone wishes to do that, or we could move to a motion, or what's the pleasure of the council?
Do we need a motion, or do we just need to give staff?
Say, go ahead, charge ahead.
Ms. Green, are you okay with just us saying move forward?
I'm comfortable with general direction. It doesn't have to be a motion.
Okay. I think we have consensus to move forward, don't we?
Okay, I think we do. Everybody's in agreement with that. Okay, Councilmember Bennett would like a word.
Yeah, I'm totally in favor of doing something. I don't have a problem with that, and I see needs and all that. And just for the record, I was on the capital campaign committee that built the facility on Chapala, so I am quite familiar with the Salvation Army. But in any case, funding is the major issue, and it's always the stumbling block. And I don't have a problem with taking it from CDBG, but as I said, I would like staff to come up with some ideas as to where the funds that we take from one social service group and we're going to give it to another, we're going to be impacting others in the community that have been previously supported. And I just think we need to know that up front before we start making decisions. And that's all I ask of staff, is that we go forward and get that information together as a part of the package, so there's no future misunderstandings or disappointments on the potential impacts on all that. Thank you.
I thought it was going to be funded out of council members' pensions. No, I may have gotten that wrong. Okay, I think that city manager has more or less the direction from the council, so we appreciate everybody coming out. And again, to Ms. Perotti, for she's been dogging this forever, you know, and she's always contributing with us here her views on the homeless and how we need to do more. So we appreciate that very much, council member.
Well, thank you, Mayor, but I just want to say again, it's really the outreach team and Luke and C3H and Deputy Valadez and our public health, and I mean, all of us working together. I don't know if I said it before, I just want to say it again, that we are working with those that want help. There are many, unfortunately, out there that are fine with living on the street and or don't want to change in any way. But the ones that we have identified really do want our help. And so that's where we're coming from.
All right. Well, that's a very good point, too. All right. I guess we have closed this issue here. And then we will move down to our city attorney to see if we are going to meet in closed session.
Yes, Mayor, members of the council, there is a need for the council meeting closed session this afternoon. Conference with legal counsel on pending litigation, pursuant to Government Code Section 54956.9D1, with regard to the matter of City of Goleta versus Cohen. That's pending in the Sacramento Superior Court. We also have the two continued items on the personnel evaluation that were continued from this morning's special session that would be taken up as well. No reportable action is anticipated in those closed sessions.
All right, thank you, Mr. Giles. So the afternoon session of the Goleta City Council is now adjourned to closed session.
Beside me, my eyes are beaming with the memories they know. The flowers in bloom and the golden grain waving to sweethearts.
start the meeting, I just want to say that Roger's got to fly out of here at the crack of dawn. So he's been encouraging us all day to run this as quickly as possible. I just want to say that because I see a lot of our regular troublemakers in the audience. So we'll see how this goes. And here comes one more. All right. We are ready to roll. Will the evening session of the Goleta City Council come to order? Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Ready, begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Ms. Lopez, Madam Clerk, would you do the roll call?
Councilmember Seves?
Here.
Councilmember Bennett?
Here.
Councilmember Perotti?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Vallejo?
Here.
Mayor Farr?
Here.
All right, we had a closed session meeting. If the city attorney was to speak to that.
Yes, the council did meet in closed session this afternoon on a conference with legal counsel on a pending litigation. No reportable action was taken on that item.
All right. Are there, I guess we're doing public forum next, and I think we're all here just to discuss specific issues. I don't think there's any broad-based comments. I have Ken Tatros here, but... What are you speaking to, Ken?
Monarchs.
Oh, Monarchs. Okay. Well, then, I guess we do have you now, then. Thank you.
I think you have some of the photographs I submitted. And basically, I'm going to read an email that I sent to Mr. Morganson, the Public Works Director. It's in regard to the drought effects for the Elwood Maine Butterfly Preserve. We all love this preserve, and I have been visiting it with some very often irregular across each of the 45 years I've been in the Elwood area, Goleta. I have seen it in full flesh and in late 70s and early 80s and witnessed a slow decline since. I was there last Tuesday, 8 November 2016, and observed what I see as a very dry and devastated grove. Even though I'm not an expert on trees, it seems to me that the drought is taking its toll. With the monarchs just beginning to arrive for the 2016-2017 winter overseason, folks will be coming in again in goodly numbers to see the monarchs. My concern is if we get more rain this year, and boy, are we praying for that, we may have some issues with the grove. The eucalyptus trees are sucking up that fine moisture, and at the same time, they being so drought stressed, is there a good chance of some of them falling this winter rain season and onto the observation areas of the grove when folks and their children are there? If we have not already done so, we may want to have our arborists take a good assessment to the status of the grove. I spoke to Lynn Kirby on this, and she encouraged me to attend this meeting and share with you my observations and concerns. So here I am. I mentioned to Lynn I could take some photos and share that with you and the panel, and above, and you have those before you today. So also there's a link on the back of this email. I think the email is even passed to you on your computer, so you could bring them up on your screen if you want to. But it's looking pretty grim out there. I just want to bring that attention to it. I'm not sure how many people have had a chance to get out there and take a look at it, but we may want to have a good look at what's going on out there. So, and any questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
No, thank you, Ken. We appreciate your interest in this and you're taking the time to do this. And you're encouraged to come tonight because we actually have people here who know a great deal about trees. So maybe we can get them to comment on this in passing. if we have to worry about the butterfly grove. Okay, we had something that our city manager wanted us, for reasons of scheduling, wanted us to pull into the evening session, and that is the new restricted parking zones on Ward Drive. So we're going to discuss that first. And we have Rosemary Gaglione and Teresa Lopes as the senior project engineer on this.
Okay, good evening, Mr. Mayor and members of the council. This is just a brief overview of the Ward Drive Class 2 bike lanes project and the proposed restricted parking area. This slide shows the project in its entirety, where it plans to extend from where the existing Class 2 bike lanes end south of Hollister Avenue, near where the off-ramp from 217 comes into Ward Drive, and they'll extend all the way south to the end of Ward Drive to connect up to the Auburn Trail. For members of the audience who may not be aware and are wondering what is a Class 2 bike lane, the Class 2 bike lane is the one that you see. It's typically 5 feet wide, and it is adjacent to a travel lane separated by a white stripe. So in this picture, you can see by the black dotted lines where the new parking restrictions are being proposed as part of the project. The majority of this length is north of Equal Street. And through this area, there's an existing curb and gutter, and the street is wide enough, the shoulder area is wide enough through there to allow on-street parking. Currently in that area, the only parking restriction is the oversized vehicle parking restriction, but other vehicles are allowed to park there. And once the Class 2 bike lane project is completed, you can see on the section below the photo that as part of the project, we're planning on shifting the center line over to the east and trying to use as much of the existing roadway that's out there now. And by doing this, we'll be shifting, or we'll be adding the Class 2 bike lane against that curb and gutter. And for that reason, we will need to restrict parking through this area, since we don't want vehicles parking in the bike lane. And if you go out there now, I've been out there at all times of the day and night, and also on weekends, and I've never seen a vehicle parked in that area, especially particularly north of Equal Street. South of Equal Street, we have the same existing roadway section, but that area is actually already posted as no parking. And then there's one other short section on the west side of Ward, just north of the Rancho Goleta community in front of Coastal Copy, which we're also proposing to restrict parking in that area. It's a short little section where parking is currently allowed. And I wanted to add that I had not received any comments from the public regarding this parking restriction. And that's the end of my presentation, so opening up for questions.
All right. Do any council members have a question of Ms. Lopes? Yeah, Ms. Perotti.
Thank you, Mayor. So you've gone out and talked to the folks at the mobile home park?
Yes.
I saw that in the report. And they don't park out on the road at night?
Where they park is in front of the Rancho Goleta community, which that area is not included as part of the this parking restriction.
Okay.
And we did go out and do a presentation to the community at their monthly HOA meeting. We've also distributed a survey to all of the residents there, and we received about 100 of those back. And we're currently working with them on some options for the front of their community, maintaining as much of the parking as they're requiring. So we're working with them on some options where we may eliminate some pockets in order to have a kind of a little bulb out to save some of the trees along there. And so it's kind of a give and take of how many of the trees would you like us to keep? How much of the parking do you want to keep? Mm-hmm. So we're currently going through that process with them.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else? Council members with a comment? No. And
I have a question.
Okay, yeah, Council Member of Civics.
What was the genesis of this project? Where'd this idea come from?
As I recall, there wasn't a connection to the Auburn Trail, and so this was added until the San Jose Creek bike path south gets in. There isn't an easily bikeable path, if you will, for bicyclists to get from Hollister down to the Auburn Trail, and that's where this got added as a CIP project quite a while ago. There also are a number of people who go to work in those areas that don't have cars, and they don't have a place to walk or bike, and so we just figured, and we had reports of cars going traveling at a pretty good rate of speed there, and some folks not feeling comfortable bicycling or even walking, and that's where this came from.
Just a quick question.
Mayor Pro Tem Vallejo.
For the record, it's Councilman Aceves' fault that you have to be here at night. We were willing to push this off until the next meeting, but he insisted on doing it tonight. So, Teresa and Rosemary, I'm sorry you extended your day.
Not a problem.
So, just to make sure I understand.
Would you hurry up a little bit?
To be sure I understand, though, you went out and looked, and this parking is not really being used that much, if at all. I mean, I'm sure it is occasionally, but when you went out to look, there wasn't anybody using these. It's not a overly parked area where this is going to be an issue for the neighborhoods or anything like that.
Correct. And I believe the reason that this parking isn't utilized is all the businesses along that stretch have their own parking lots. So I have not seen vehicles parked there.
Okay. Thank you. Just wanted to make sure.
Yeah. Council Member Perugia.
I just want to make a quick comment that my husband works on this street, and I was asking him, because he's for the last 12 years has driven this stretch of roadway, and I asked him, do you ever see cars out there? And he said, no, there's just not any issue with cars, because just of what you said, there's plenty of parking in the lots that the businesses have there. So.
Okay. All right.
No. Let me say, I think this is a great idea, you know. Anything we can do to get people out of their cars and on their bikes and address public safety issues for people that are taking their life into their hands, venturing out on the streets with no protection. Anyway, I think it's a great idea. And I think we pretty much...
I would just be happy to make the motion if we're done.
Okay, if you would. Please.
Okay. I move we adopt resolution number 16, next in order, entitled a resolution of the City Council of the City of Goleta, California, designating a no parking zone on Ward Drive.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passes unanimously.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, you folks, for your presentation. Okay, Madam Clerk, would you read the next on the agenda?
Item D1, adoption of the revised urban forest management plan.
Okay, Ms. Gagliani is now joined by Kathleen Trepa, our deputy city manager.
Chair.
Mayor Farr, members of council, yes, that's correct. And Kathleen is going to lead the presentation here.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, members of the City Council. The item before you this evening is a recommendation from the Public Tree Advisory Commission to adopt revisions to the Urban Forest Management Plan, which was initially adopted by the City Council in June of 2011. The commission, commonly referred to as PTAC, began reviewing the UFMP in the fall of 2014 and has very diligently considered the language in the plan from cover to cover over a series of meetings since that time. PTAC is recommending a number of revisions throughout the plan. Therefore, staff has provided a redlined version of the edited plan as attachment 2 for easy reference. The original plan, as approved by the City Council, included a broad array of recommendations and strategies to develop a robust urban forest management program over time. If some of those recommendations have been implemented since the original plan was adopted, such as the creation of an advisory tree board, then the Commission provided revised language to reflect that action has already taken place. However, there are other recommendations that have not been considered at this time and or implemented, and they remain stated in the draft revised document as a recommendation to be considered at a future date. An example of that would be in Section 4.1, canopy coverage, where the plan recommends that the City consider a policy of no net loss of public trees. Such a policy has not yet been evaluated by staff or PTAC, and therefore that remains a future consideration in the revised draft plan. While a number of edits have been made throughout the plan, there are several notable changes that we would like to highlight for you at this time. In Section 4.4, a tree species eligibility list was originally included in the UFMP as adopted by the Council in June 2011. The Commission decided to recommend removal of this list, and they recrafted the section for Council's consideration. So while the section still envisions providing a list of trees that could be appropriately planted in the Goleta area in terms of climate and environmental conditions, the Commission would like to remove that specific list and at some point in the future consider a new list. In the meantime, there are online databases like Select Tree that are available for people to utilize to help select a tree for a particular location. For public trees in parkways and medians, the City Council previously adopted a street tree list that is specific for these particularly small growth spaces. PTAC recommends that this list be formally included in the UFMP. The street tree list was originally prepared by a subcommittee of the Design Review Board and approved by Council in March of 2013. At that same meeting in 2013, the City Council also approved tree planting guidelines, which PTAC also recommends be included in the UFMP, and that would then replace references to other planting standards and guidelines as noted in Section 4.5, the right tree in the right place. Another area that staff would like to bring to Council's attention is Section 4.15 related to heritage trees. The originally adopted UFMP recommended that a heritage tree program be considered. PTAC did consider some language, which the Commission has included in the draft revised plan, and the Commission recommends that Council consider this language for adoption at this time. As staff notes in the staff report, the Planning Department has embarked upon a project to develop a historic preservation ordinance and implementation program, which will also include historic or heritage trees as a component of that overall plan. In that regard, a consulting urban forestry firm has been retained to survey all trees planted in the community prior to 1970. Based on that information, public input, and best practices in urban forestry, staff expects that planning will develop a proposed program that may or may not necessitate some realignment in the UFMP to maintain program consistency between the two documents. As a result, if the language proposed tonight is approved, there may be a need to bring some revisions back before PTAC and the City Council with regard to heritage trees or not, depending on the program that is ultimately developed. Conversely, Council could approve the language tonight and direct that no nominations for heritage trees be considered until such time as the survey work and the subsequent historic preservation program is developed. And at that time, once the program is finalized, nominations could then be received and considered so that there's consistency between the two documents. In addition to the changes noted above, throughout the document, the Commission recommends that some language be removed, such as a list of available urban forest and tree care resources, a section related to working with nonprofits to assist staff with implementing the plan or adherence to certain safety standards or tree care standards. While doing so is PTAC's recommendation, staff would also note that the removal of this language does not necessarily prevent staff or the public from still utilizing those resources as standards, as guidelines, or as options as opportunities arise. For example, if a group of Eagle Scouts wanted to assist with a tree planting effort that was consistent with our goals and resources, we would certainly partner with that group on such a project with or without any language in the UFMP. So it doesn't preclude us from continuing to move forward with regard to how we manage the community's urban forest. The goal of the Urban Forest Management Plan is to be a living document that is implemented over time as the city's program expands and resources are dedicated to maintaining the community's public trees, while the plan envisions updates as policies or considers and conditions change. That essentially concludes our presentation. I would like to acknowledge that we have two commissioners here in the audience tonight. We have Chair Messner and Commissioner Massney, and I'm sure they are available also to answer any questions and provide some comments with regard to the process and the plan itself. And with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, are there any questions of Ms. Trepa? Okay, we have a number of people who want to comment on this. Chris, you want to fill out a slip? Okay. Barbara Massey, if you would, followed by Richard Foster, followed by Ken Knight.
Sounds like me sometimes in the morning. Good evening. Let me first say that although I am Vice Chair of the Public Tree Advisory Commission, I speak for myself this evening. The plan has two minor issues in formatting. They are the appendices on pages 153 through 160 need to be enlarged to fit the page. They were obviously scanned and they're too small. So, but that's a simple thing, and there's a lone half of parentheses on page 139 on the second paragraph. The first urban forest management plan was written at a cost to the city of over $40,000. Later we found out that it was prepared from a free online template. That UFMP had to be revised by several council members before it could even be adopted. The Public Tree Advisory Commission was tasked with revising it to be clearer, more accurate, and more useful. As you may see by my binder over there, we looked at a lot of information. That binder is only for the meetings. It does not include all that we read and studied in preparing the UFMP. PTAC has prepared a document that addresses the urban forest as well as research and is a well-researched, clear, concise, cost-effective, and objective manner. The red line copy explains in the margin many of our decisions. You will also find footnotes indicating the source of the information. There has been public input from nonprofits such as Audubon, as well as a number of individuals. Mr. Knight himself has spoken to a number of PTAC meetings. I could respond to the criticism of Mr. Knight, but I think it was done well in the red line version. The reasons for the decision are provided there. I ask that you give direction to the Planning Commission and Design Review Board to refer to the UFMP and specifically the street tree planting list when reviewing landscaping in the public right-of-way. There are members who insist on using inappropriate trees and disregarding the list. I would like to thank Ms. Scaglione, Mr. Morgenstern, and Ms. Moreno for helping the members of PTAC prepare a good UFMP for the city. This is a good document, and I ask that you adopt the revised Urban Forest Management Plan this evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Massey, and thank you for your Herculean task there. We appreciate that. Mr. Foster, if you would.
Mayor Farr and council members, the UFMP's had a long and rocky road to this point. The original $47,000 contract called for one person to write the entire thing and for council to be notified if there was any changes in staff and to require their approval. Yet it was 6 months after George Bloomfield disappeared that the council, that the city manager was told that George Jimenez was taking over. And 2 months after that, there was an email saying that Ken Knight was taking over. None of this was ever approved by council, despite the fact the contract required this. Of this first 200-plus-page draft, council member Ed Easton wrote an email to the state, quote, "The draft urban forestry plan Ken Knight submitted to the city of Goleta was reviewed and extensively revised by a special committee composed of council member Michael Bennett, myself, and city director of community services Steve Wagner. The committee was delegated the task of extensively revising the draft plan to make general policy statements out of specific requirements Mr. Knight had written. Mr. Knight's organization would have controlled much of the city's urban forestry work if the plan had been adopted as written." The special committee's revised plan was a much more workable 95 pages, but still required onerous reporting on part of city staff that they simply do not have the time to fulfill. A plan that relies upon volunteer groups to make these reports or do work is not a viable plan. For example, the mortality rate among nonprofit planted trees on Cathedral Oaks at Windsor or along 101 at Los Caneros far exceeds the 4% mortality rate required in the UFMP. Yet the nursery spec trees that were professionally planted at Los Caneros traffic circle are tall, vibrant, and looking quite healthy. Or consider the fact that the 50 oak trees that were planted along Cathedral Oaks by La Patera Ranch were supposed to be public trees are all planted on La Patera's properties, and they were planted under the supervision of a licensed certified arborist. 3 years ago, this committee was formed, and during those 3 years, I believe the only public comments were from Audubon Society, myself, and Mr. Knight. I would say the public's had plenty of opportunity to address any issues in here. The commissioners have worked hard. They've put in long hours. For the first year and a half, they weren't even paid the stipend. In fact, probably under rules from Dan Singer, they had to print out their own packets for the first year with their own ink and their own printer. They've brought you a well-revised UFMP. One could argue the points in it forever. Back in August, Ms. Trepa asked the city's arborist to review the plan. He had plenty of comments, changing things that Mr. Knight, who's also an arborist, put in there. Policy wonks could argue about this plan forever. For 5 months, the city did not have time to even have a meeting because staff's so overburdened. Let's wrap this up, let's stop the talking, and actually start implementing the plan. Lastly, changing words like consider and recommend is useful because this should be your policy statement. That's not something the commission could do. For example, right now it says consider planting a diversity of trees. That's not the same as saying plant a diversity of trees. And so the recommended clarification I think would be useful. Please adopt the UFMP. They really put a lot of time and hard work into this.
All right, Ken Knight, please.
Hello, I'm Ken Knight, and I love coming to these meetings to get attacked from past practices, but let's deal with the legal necessities of this plan. Page 32 wipes out the American National Standards. I don't know if any of you actually deal with this stuff, but there is safety standards, a whole book of them, and a whole series of guidelines. These are standards that are used nationally by everyone, and it's legally defensible because everybody uses it. But we're going to throw them away, and what we're going to use instead is the best management practices, also another great series of guidelines. But these are guidelines supposed to be used in conjunction with the standards we've just thrown away, in addition to the safety standards. And it's all relying upon a three-page document that the council passed back in 2013. And I don't think it was your intent to pass standards at that time that nobody else in the country goes by, and that do not really deal with tree care. The people on the Public Tree Advisory Commission are well-meaning people, but they simply don't know trees. You could see that on the tree care or on the tree list. They had two trees, same tree. They didn't catch it. We've been working on this for 3 years. They didn't catch it. Nobody on staff caught it. I don't understand how you can create a plan. And again, we don't have the consulting arborist here, the city's consulting arborist. You may say, well, you don't trust me because I have a particular point of view. What about the consulting arborist for the city? Not here. And not reviewing the plan. What I ask for is that this is a politically motivated attempt to get this plan through, and it's not going to get reviewed again for another 10 years. And it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been public workshops on this. There's been a lot of public meetings and a lot of talk within the commission members, but not out to the public, not like we do other plans. You have the bikeway plan right now. You have all kinds of meetings that are taking place out in the public, workshops where you can discuss what's going on. It doesn't happen here. Most of the workshops, supposedly, from the PTAC, have been at 4:30 in the afternoon, when very few people can make it. I would encourage you to not proceed at this point, but to take it a little bit stronger and try to develop a plan that is not just Goleta-centric, but deals with national standards. Thank you.
All right. Chris, did you want to come to the podium and say anything? No. Okay. Are there comments and questions from the council? Ms. Perotti.
Thank you, Mayor. I just have a question about the arborist. Ken Knight's comment on the arborist not reviewing this, our arborist, but he did review this.
That's correct.
And his input?
He provided some input with regard to some technical sections. For example, the root guards he recommended be installed to 24-inch depth as opposed to the plan's original 18-inch depth, but the commission decided to keep the 18 inches. He made some corrections to the street tree list in terms of the botanic names. The commission did accept those changes. They were corrections to some errors in the Latin, which admittedly none of us would have caught. So he did make some of those. We did make those corrections. He looked at some other areas within the plan itself, some of which the commission kept and others they did not. So it just depended on the section. But he did review the plan.
Okay. And I guess the other question I have is I know that we as the council have all received input from Chris Messner, the chair, making several recommendations on changing some wording. One of the ones that really stands out to me is guideline recommendations replaced with guidelines. Has this gone to the full count, the full commission for review?
No, these were comments that were submitted following the commission's meeting, so they were submitted directly to the city council. They have not gone before the commission itself. Whether he commented, whether he forwarded those to the commission, he may have. I'm not aware, but they were not discussed by the commission.
We discussed it. We discussed at the commission about the consider, why have consider when it goes to council, because it's there's no longer a consideration and recommendations. But at that time, we were at the end of our time, and it was like we just wanted to get this passed off to you. So we did talk about it, but we didn't come to a full conclusion on that.
Excuse me, Chris.
Yeah.
Are we to assume that you are in favor of passing this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, definitely pass it. My concern was that we want to make it in present tense now. Now it's no longer considering. It's no longer recommendation, so it'd be easier for you guys. We can't say it's passed, so it goes to you, and you all can just change some of that verbiage. It's not changing the UFMP itself. It's just making it now present law.
Okay, the objections that Ken brought up, will that at some point come for some discussion?
I don't know. I mean, we had public meetings before the UFMP. Ken led them all right here in this room. So I don't know where his fantasy is, but there was a lot of meetings. So the public was involved.
Well, no, I was just more interested in your professional opinion.
My professional opinion is this is a good document, and we spent a lot of time on it, and we worked on it. And there was a lot of self-serving and for special interest in here, and that just wasn't going to fly with the commission. We wanted the city in control. The city has their own finances, and they can direct it from there.
All right. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Any questions of Chris while we have him there? No? All right. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Yeah. Would you, Council Member Aceves?
Thank you. Ms. Trepa, I can't find it when I wanted it, but this little theatrics of throwing books on the floor has to deal with ANSI and ISA. And if I read your redlined comments, somewhere you said that there's a charge for ANSI, whereas ISA's free. Did I read that right?
To obtain the ANSI standards, yes, you have to pay. You have to purchase the standards.
Okay, but you don't have to for ANSI.
For the ISA, no.
Oh, for ISA. Okay, and that's what came out of commission.
That's what was discussed at the commission meeting at that time.
Now, that's a significant binder that Ms. Massey had. How many meetings did PTAC have dealing with this issue, approximately?
The review of the UFMP or the ANSI standards themselves?
No, the review of the FMP.
Oh, no, we had more of that. I would have to go back and look off the top of my head. I can't tell you. They've been reviewing it for approximately 2 years. And since I've been here since September of 2015, when the was my first meeting, we've probably had 6 meetings in the last year, 7 perhaps. So I would hazard a guess that they've probably discussed this 12 or 15 times, if not more.
And all those were public televised meetings?
I don't know if they were all televised, but certainly the commission meetings are public.
Councilmember Aceves, I think about halfway through that they became televised. That's correct.
Okay. Well, I want to personally thank the chair, Chris Messner, and Barbara Massey, who's my appointee. This is really good. And I like the fact that we have the strikeout version so you can look at where the discussion was and where the document ended up. So I'm sorry it took so much time, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, but it's a good document, and I'm ready to move forward on it.
Well, yeah, let's get a final poke in here, if you would, Councilmember Bennett.
Well, I don't know that I'm going to do any poking, but and I don't know who can answer this, whether it's our city attorney or whether it's staff, but there's been an assertion made that by not using the ANSI standards, the city will lack a meaningful defense in lawsuits involving public street trees and tree care. So where do we stand in that assertion that's been made?
The courts will be very deferential to the city council and the city council's choice of what standards to follow. You know, I certainly have not reviewed the competing standards that are out there. I certainly have not looked at it from the from some of the assertions that have been made. But I would say, as a general principle of the law, courts are going to be deferential to the city council in selecting which standards. Courts are loath to impose upon an elected body what rules they choose to govern. If, on the other hand, what was presented was an absence of rules, either in the document or in the implementation, there are multiple areas where you could establish the standards that would be used for those maintenance. You'll have maintenance contracts. You'll have maintenance policies. You'll have a number of other areas. But if the court was presented with the city council didn't choose a standard, but they chose to ignore any standard and didn't implement it in any other realm, then they would say, well, we can't defer to a choice the council made because the council didn't make a choice. So the discussion that I've heard here this evening is that what your advisory body has recommended to you is a different set of guidelines or standards or rules or however it wants to be characterized, and the general proposition of law is that the courts will defer to your choice on those issues.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other comments from council? Yeah. Councilmember Perotti.
Well, I would also like to thank the full commission. I know that once they started, you started having your meetings televised, I was able to watch a few, and they went on for quite a while. So I really give you lots of credit. You've done an outstanding job, one that we asked you to do, and you did it very well. And I'm very comfortable with what you've proposed and what I've heard tonight. So thank you.
Okay, Mayor Pro Tem Vallejo.
I wasn't sure if you saw me over here. I kept almost jumped up and down. I think I'm just going to echo what everybody else said. I want to thank the commission. You guys worked. It was an arduous process, obviously, from everything that's been described, and I appreciate that. And I think the results are in the document we have in front of us. And I thank you both, and I thank the public, like Mr. Foster over there, for also participating. And I think we have a document that we intended. We spent time as a committee and as a public weighing in, making the changes we thought were important, and now we're ready to move forward.
Councilmember Aceves.
I'm ready for a motion if you are.
If I could, I have two comments.
Please.
Yeah, I like what Mr. Messner presented to us. And then I heard that this thing is locked in concrete for 10 years. I'm not familiar with why that would be, because as far as I know, on any document that we adopt, we can make changes in the future. So I have no problem in adopting tonight what's being proposed, but assuming that we can do this, I would like to suggest that we refer those suggestions that Mr. Messner has made back to the PTAC, so they can take the time necessary to review that and make sure that they can come to council. Because I think the issue of, it is our policy versus a consideration of or whatever, I have a bit of a problem with that. So, and I know there's a lot of wording in here, and I would think staff should be able to go through that and make the appropriate suggested changes in a strikeout, for example, and let's come back. And if the PTAC can't come to a consensus on it, then we know that you've reviewed it and to this degree, then you bring it back to us and we'll take care of it from there. But that would just be aside from a motion to approve this thing.
That's an addendum, more or less.
Huh? Well, I just wanted to be sure. I'm getting nodding heads that this could be done, it could be accomplished. And that's all I was concerned about, because I don't want to see it disappear. I'd like to see it reviewed, come to a conclusion, and bring that part of it back to us.
Okay, although we are going to vote on it now. You're for that.
Well, I'm for adopting what's before us.
And I understand what you're saying. The recommended changes from Mr. Messner are basically, at this point, a minority opinion because it wasn't vetted by the commission. So as a commission vets it out, and if they see that there's a need to change some verbiage, then we could make an easy change on an adopted plan.
That's a good point.
So I'd make the motion that we...
Wait. Let me just say something here, if you don't mind. I wanted to add Ken in there when we're thanking people for making a contribution. It's difficult. You didn't carry the day here, but, you know, you put a lot of time into this. You thought about it. You're here, as frequently other members of this group are here, to examine what is going on up here and making comments and criticisms about it. And that's actually, you know, what we're looking for, the thesis, the antithesis, the synthesis. So your contribution is appreciated, too.
Could I have one more? Just one more question?
Oh, let's take a vote on it. You come up and you can berate me after we vote. Yeah?
Go ahead.
All right. Councilmember Civitz.
Well, I'd make a motion that we approve and adopt the revised urban forest management plan with the proviso that we do not accept any heritage tree applications until that item is gone through the zoning process. And but we'll keep the language in as listed, subject to a change if there needs to be one later. So,
second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Passes unanimously. So thank you, folks, for your contribution. And certainly labored in the vineyards a long time on this, and it always seemed to me a bit Byzantine, all of this. So I appreciate the scorecard that the staff has created. So thank you. Ladies, thank you for your help. We appreciate that. We seem to have done our business here, huh?
Almost.
All right, so we're down to council comments. Mr. Aceves, if you would.
Thank you. November 5th, we had another successful Beautify Goleta project. Is that me?
No, is that what that is? Somebody get some WD-40.
There you go. Anyway, on Saturday, November 5th, we had another Beautify Goleta project. We did it on two streets, Alondra and Mallard. I want to thank Councilmember Perotti for joining us. And she didn't let up. She was hauling the stuff like everybody else, and we had a lot of fun. I'm waiting for the results from staff, so maybe our city manager can get Everett to give you the information and maybe provide it to us in an email or your weekly report.
Yeah, I just received that
okay.
This morning or last night, so I'll be able to provide that to you in a weekly, in this week's weekly.
And also want to thank the CERT volunteers. They all showed up again and worked all day. I know the tonnage is going to be more than the first event because we did four 40-yard roll-offs, and last time we only did three. So people are very pleased. And, in fact, there's a gentleman who lives on Alondra who has been in communication with me since 2015 complaining about the condition of his street. And he was so pleased, and what really impressed him the most, the fact that we posted the street no parking and cleaned up the entire street, which he doesn't recall that ever being done. And I think we towed two cars. So he was very pleased. I mean, he kept bringing stuff out like crazy, and he was just very happy. On the 3rd, we had the Discovery Storage Center. I want to say it wasn't a groundbreaking ribbon cutting. It was more of a presentation of the completion of the project. And boy, was that a great event with the Land Rover,
Lunar.
Lunar Rover. So that was a great event. On the 7th of November, I attended a Edison roundtable, and it was sponsored with Edison and CEC dealing with our peaker plant, and that was well attended. I have lined up an MTD trolley for the Christmas parade if council chooses to participate or staff wants to participate. I only ask that the city manager work the final details out with MTD as to how many people can ride it and then get some sign-ups. But, I thought it'd be a great idea for the first Christmas parade to come down. And in fact, Councilmember Vallejo, you can join us even though...
I'll probably be working. I'm managing that.
You're parade. Managing that.
Yeah.
Okay. Make sure we get a good lineup then.
Yeah, maybe.
And finally, tomorrow morning at 5:30, I'm flying out of Goleta to Pittsburgh, attending the National Congress of Cities. And the program that they have put together is really, really, I mean, some really good stuff. They're dealing with a lot of issues, but I'll be focusing on small cities, and there's also a section on upcoming federal programs that small cities can utilize. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm not looking forward to the cold because I understand it will be snowing while I'm back there, but you got to do what you got to do. That's my report. Thank you.
All right. I would think the variety would be interesting, though, weather-wise. Okay, Mayor Pro Tem Vallejo, would you please share with us?
Yeah, just a couple of things. I was at the Discovery Center event, too, and, you know, I guess like I did that night, I just want to thank the Investec people who built that. I mean, they could have just built a storage center, and instead they made sure to remind people of the great things that the city's accomplished in its past and still accomplishing, but it was really neat to see what they did as far as the Lunar Rover goes, and the Delco guys were there, and they even had the trainer vehicle out there, which I guess people were sitting in. I was terrified I would break it, so I didn't climb into it, but it was neat to see all that history of Goleta there. We had a finance and audit committee meeting, which we already saw the results of through today's presentation, so I won't add to that. There have been Christmas parade meetings ongoing. We're looking for participants, so if anybody wants to participate in the parade, whether your organization or whatever the case might be, or just you want to put your kids in Santa hats and walk them down the street, well, hopefully more than that, but we're looking for participants in the parade. Let's leave it at that. This isn't the Rose Parade. Let's not get carried away. But it should be a really neat event. We're almost ready. I think we're waiting to hear if Deputy Valadez is going to join us in the parade. He stopped making eye contact as soon as I started talking about the parade. I'm kidding. But we're getting some. We're working on that, and it's gone really well. And I want to thank the committee that's been running it, helping participate in getting the first parade. As you might imagine, the first one's always the hard one. So it's been more work than it probably will be going forward. And then I guess the only other thing I would add is a belated thank you to all the veterans. We had Veterans Day on Friday, and it's always a day where hopefully we think about our veterans every day, but especially on Veterans Day, of course. And so belated Happy Veterans Day to anybody who served as well. And that's it.
Mr. Mayor, may I ask a question of Councilmember Vallejo? For the Christmas parade, if there are members of the public or nonprofits or other groups, community groups, how do they get information about submitting an entry for the parade? Who do they contact?
They could contact, I think it's GoletaChristmasParade.com, but as long as you know who they are, tell them to contact Patricia Fabing, who's one of the co-chairs of this event. Perhaps we have some ballet dancers who want to participate in the parade.
We might.
Oh, very good. If that fails, then you know how to reach me for sure, and I'll make sure we find them. Okay?
Very good. I'm looking forward to that. I think it'll be fun. Councilmember Perotti?
Thank you, Mayor. Well, I don't know if anybody else received this invitation, but I received an invitation to go on November the 2nd to a Bacara Spa event. I didn't see any of you guys there.
That's the naked one?
Must have lost mine in the mail.
It was really, it was advertising their new product and just kind of promoting their spa. It was a really nice event, and I'm glad I went. It was put on by Santa Barbara Magazine, so it was really lovely. November the 4th, we did the finance. Mayor Pro Tem Vallejo and myself, we were on the Finance and Audit Committee, which we had a discussion on today. Then November the 5th was Beautify Goleta, and yes, I really enjoyed getting out there and really helping, and I really hurt the next day. That's all I could say. I didn't feel so bad that day when I went home, but the next day I woke up and it was more my upper body, because I'm not used to all the things that we lifted. My legs were fine, but it was really great to see all the volunteers out there and just everybody kind of working together, and it was amazing how much stuff we took away and how much better it looked afterwards. I mean, I wish I had done some before and after pictures, and I didn't. But yeah, I'm glad we're working on that, and I'm ready for another one. November the 9th, C3H weekly meeting. November the 10th, C3H Policy Council, which meets quarterly. And we had a great presentation on what each region is doing. So we had the North County Regional Update by Jeff Schaefer, and he focuses on the outreach team for Santa Maria, Lompoc, San Ynez. Then Luke Barrett did his presentation on South County Regional Update, and there he presented on Carpinteria, what's going on there, what's going on in the city of Santa Barbara, and Goleta. So it was really a nice presentation, and we're really, everybody's doing so much more to really look at the homeless population and see what their needs are. November the 11th, I had DEVRO board meeting, and we are going to be having, the DEVRO board will be having their first fundraiser, and it's called Art and Soul, and then we'll have art by their residents and also local artists for sale and other things for sale, and it'll be a cocktail party. It's on, put it on your calendar, January 28th. It'll be at Decker's Rotunda. And I think Decker's also will be presenting a portion of their, they'll keep their store open that night and will donate a portion of all sales to DEVRO. So it's 4 to 7 on, I will keep talking about it until January 28th, but I hope a lot of people can come. It's, DEVRO's a great, great place that really works with our adult population with special needs. That's all I have.
Uh-huh. Now, Mayor Farr, real quick. It is GoletaChristmas.com, so for those of you watching on TV, if you're interested in volunteering, participating, donating is always nice as well. GoletaChristmas.com, you'll find links for everything there.
All right, Councilmember Bennett.
Well, I have a very short report tonight. I, too, attended the Discovery Storage ribbon cutting, and which, of course, is phenomenal that the Delco crew that were here and all the things they did with the Lunar Rover, among so many other things that they did there, but certainly the Lunar Rover is one of the better known things. And it's significant because where the storage facility has been constructed is a portion of the area that they actually tested the Lunar Rover and made adjustments to it. So they thought it would work okay up on the moon, which of course, when they got there, it did. So that was pretty exciting. The other item that I was involved with is the annual Veterans Day program that's put on at the Goleta Valley Community Center. And I was asked to do a reading, which I did, from a veteran in World War I. And those readings are always very moving. This is a letter that was written home after the war by a veteran and was writing to his family. And as I say, they're always touching, and it was certainly inspirational. We had a nice turnout, lots of veterans there that were recognized, and our keynote speaker was the Chief Master Sergeant from Vandenberg Air Force Base. So that was rather inspiring as well. So that concludes my report.
All right, thank you. I attended a Economic Development and Revitalization Committee.
I forgot that one.
Yeah, the Mayor Pro Tem was there, and we chatted. Actually, Jaime Valdez made a very interesting presentation on the occupancy rates of Goleta, particularly for the office buildings and for general use as well. And we're doing very well here, as you might be able to guess. And the hotels, too, have a very high, I think the average was like 80%, and someone said it's over 65% hotels are doing well. So anyway, that was good. And then Kristen Miller made she and her friend Courtney Hebert and Paulina Tron made a good presentation about the opportunity to work closer with Santa Barbara. And we had the Santa Barbara, what was her name, do you remember?
Kathy Janega Dykes, I think. Uh-huh. I always forget Kathy's full name, but I think that's right. Would Visit Santa Barbara. Oh, they renamed themselves. They're not Visit Santa Barbara anymore.
They are still Visit Santa Barbara. It's the other group, the hotel and restaurant conference group that renamed themselves.
Oh, I thought she, okay, good.
Yeah, no.
Okay, well, the woman, the head of Visit Santa Barbara, is that what it is?
Yes, Kathy Janega Dykes.
Well, she did a terrific presentation, and
They have invited Goleta's Chamber to participate with them. I'm not sure who initiated that, but the Chamber made a very interesting presentation on what they are doing to promote tourism in our area and the new graphics they're working with. And all in all, it was quite an impressive presentation. You want to add anything to that?
Only that they're working with Visit Santa Barbara through the T-Bid. That's what initiated that, and of course the city matches those funds that the T-Bid brings across, and so it's an important differentiator only because T-Bid has to be used exclusively for overnight stays, and the money we provide allows them to also branch out and help local restaurants, and specifically this year they're focusing on Old Town to increase the revenue for the merchants of Old Town and just make it a go-to place in Goleta. So it was a great report. Kathy had nothing but positive things to say about the future, and we just got to stay the course. So things are going well.
All right. Yeah, no, it was a very upbeat presentation. And that concludes what I have to say. Does our city manager, Michelle Green, have a report?
Just very briefly, a reminder that next week we will have 2 days of holiday closure, Thursday, November 24th, and Friday, November 25th, so no city offices will be open.
All right, Mr. City Attorney, Tim? No? No report. Well, and all of you are probably aware where that brings us at this point. So, if there is no further comment or other things to say before we adjourn, we will now adjourn the evening session of the Goleta City Council.
With nothing to do, talking to myself about you, talking to myself.